I never want to go home. I love Paris, and I love these clothes and the little church, and I love you.
What did you say?
I love Paris.
Yours, mine, theirs.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the fourth greatest podcast about movies, and the only one where we use the wisdom of democracy to choose what crazy movies we watch. So, welcome. I'm Roy, and I'm not the one with the firm young body. I'm the one that has the sagging breasts.
Nice. Okay. Hi, I'm John, and as the oldest person here, I'm very disappointed in the potential romantic prospects of the other hosts and guests here on this podcast today.
Hi, I'm Ammon, and I'm just glad that on this podcast I won't be the creepiest philosopher.
All right, so if you've stumbled on this podcast and you're listening to it for the first time, we pick a real narrow genre of movies and we watch them, and you're in luck. This time we're watching movies where the love interest is at least 25 years older, like one of the people is 25 years older than the other. It's usually guys being older, but we're also watching Harold and Maude. So we go both ways. The movies
and
we're
the actor, to be clear, right? The actors.
The actors, yeah. Because I think part of the commentary is aging actors who think they still deserve to act with really young co-stars. Right? Not just
Fred Astaire in Funny Face was playing a 30-year-old man.
Okay. So
I think that's right.
Yes. So anyway, we're watching Funny Face. We're watching we watched Harold and Maude, and we watched Shop Girl. But I think it's interesting how each of these like treats the age difference, because Funny Face ignores that there's an age difference, right? It doesn't acknowledge it at all. And Harold and Maude obviously there's no escaping the age difference, and it's treated with humor. And then Shop Girl, like, it mentions it briefly that like there is an age discrepancy there, but I think that maybe is of all of the relationships is maybe the most entitled of the three. But anyway, we'll get there. So how are you guys doing?
Wealth gap is more interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. How are you guys doing?
I'm pretty well. Yeah.
I think it's kind of fun just like not living a life where I'm dealing with the age inappropriate kind of thing happening. I feel like these movies stressed me out more than I thought they would. I thought they would all just be about fun and la 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 la, but it's like it was very stressful watching the age gap in the movies.
My sister Becky, you both know Becky, so she got married in her early 20s, and I think her husband was like 8 years older than her, and I think it kind of freaked people out a little bit. And 8 years difference isn't huge, like, for adults, right? But at the age of 22, she married a guy who was 29 or 30, and it felt a little weird. And now he's had all of his hips replaced, and he's really old. I don't know. I'm just saying stupid things, but it seems to have worked out well, right? So good for her.
Right. She can't get away now.
Yeah, she didn't end up marrying that awful Justin kid who always wanted to give me a big hug or like the handshake that starts from way up above your shoulder, and you one of those. He was pretty sweet, and I'm glad that never worked out.
Well, one thing I learned about. Okay, we're going to get to all these movies, but just kind of like, you know, one thing I learned from Shop Girl, because it's, you know, mostly from the girl's perspective, is just how annoying it is, you know, to have, like, both ends of the spectrum. It's like, well, you know, this old creepy guy, you know, that's garbage, but this young creepy guy is also garbage.
So. Arguably more garbage.
So that was the weird one, right? Because, like, She had that – anyway, we'll get there. We'll talk about it when we get there because it seems like she had two bad options. But anyway. Oh, did either of you see the director's cut of Rocky IV?
I know Ammon didn't.
did Rocky fight an older boxer in that? So he rings up.
I'm pretty sure Ivan Drago's supposed to be about 12 or 13 years younger.
Oh, okay. So there you go.
It's a younger.
So if they did it, it would have been a problem.
Yeah, when they kissed, though, I was like, oh, this is just in, like, for our podcast. So
yeah, that's why we didn't record last week, because it was on a week that we don't usually record, but it was also the only showing of Rocky IV, right?
Yeah. Did you see it, John?
No, no, you said you were off to see it, and I'm like, oh, shoot, tell me how it was.
Well, you can watch it on Amazon Prime now.
Oh, what?
I mean, not now. Like an... Don't do it now, but it's available on Amazon Prime. So I'm just going to give you – I don't want to, like, prejudice you towards it. So he gives, like, a 30-minute interview ahead of time where he talks about the worst thing about the movie, and he thinks it's the most flawed of all the films, Rocky V aside, because that doesn't exist. And he thinks that the problem with Rocky IV was that it was made in the mid-80s. And he said that he was kind of... But, like, I think that's kind of why people love it, right? He said, basically, yes. The movie is like a music video. And that's exactly what the movie's like. And so he wanted to take the material he had and turn it back into a Rocky I sort of feel, where it's a more serious story. And so he makes a better movie. I really think he does. It's a better movie, where you get more character development, you understand a little bit more where the characters are coming from, you get some more empathy for Drago, and there's just some more of that stuff. But he kind of takes away a little bit of the fun. All the reasons you just love watching Rocky IV when it comes on TV, some of those are gone. So it's interesting. But I will say there's a big change, and this isn't going to be a huge spoiler for you guys. But you know in the movie where finishes his first workout and Adrian's there and she says, I'm with you no matter what. And in the theatrical version, he challenges her, right? It's like, no matter what, right? And he kind of challenges her. And he took that away. And I'm glad he did, because, you know, her coming out to Russia to support him was really hard for her. And she's probably already feeling bad. And he doesn't need to challenge her or question her loyalty to him at that point. And so
like in the original, in the theatrical, you kind of get the sense that he guilted her into flying to Russia.
Well, and then when she gets there, he makes her feel bad for not coming out originally, right? Like like she says, I'm with you no matter what. And then he questions her really? Cause you know, where have you been? But he took that out, and I'm glad, because I never really liked that.
So now he gets mad that she he doesn't train. She doesn't train very well. He doesn't, like, you know.
She takes over the training.
Hmm.
Which is pretty great, yeah.
So you guys are big Rocky heads. That's the term, right?
I don't know if that's the term, but I'm going to say, and Andy had I had a brief discussion on Facebook about this. I think movie for movie, it's the best franchise out there. And I know you guys love Star Wars, and I think Star Wars has some, like, extraordinary films, and it has some awful, awful films. And I think Rocky V aside, I think they're all pretty good, and some of them
Star
are
Star Wars
incredible.
Has three good movies, but they're my three favorite movies. I love Star Wars,
but I don't know if any of the movies are good, right? I mean, no, that's not true. There are four good movies, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I love it despite the fact, and almost in some ways because of the fact that none of the movies live up to what I wanted them to be. But so I'm not a Rocky head. So is the reason why it's a big deal for her to go to – is she like an emigre?
So no, not at all. I was – she crosses the border illegally into Russia, right? No. So I think one of the big things in all the Rocky movies, even in Rocky V, we had this discussion because we podcasted Rocky V. By the way, we'll get back to old men and young women in just a second, is that like, Adrian is like the glue of all those films. And even in Rocky V, like, Rocky V is a huge dumpster fire, but Adrian, or Talia Shire, just pours her heart into it regardless, right? And so I feel like she has done nothing but show Rocky love and support and loyalty through every single film. And then for him to kind of challenge that, it's jarring. And they took it away, so good.
Hey, okay. Well, okay. So my big question about Rocky IV... Is it confirmed in the new version of Rocky IV that Brigitte is having an affair with that Russian fight promoter guy?
I don't know. It doesn't. No, that's not in there.
Oh man, it was heavily implied in the old version.
Oh, yeah. So they Sylvester Stallone said he was going to take out the robot, but he didn't. He left in one scene with the robot where Polly and the robot conceive a robot baby. So
there's a robot?
You've never seen Rocky IV?
I don't. I've seen Rocky I, and that's it.
Okay, so
Rocky IV is really good.
While filming Rocky IV, Sylvester Stallone was like at a pizzeria where there was a talking robot, and he's like, "It's in the movie." So
that was the '80s. They're talking robots everywhere, as we all remember.
His big thing with the recutting of the film is he said that like when I was making it, all I could think was the audience doesn't care about this emotional crap. They just the next action, the next action, the next action. And then he said, now that I'm older, like, that, you know, the movie's worthless unless there's emotional reasons to care about the characters in the film. Anyway, it's a better movie. It's probably not as fun. And, Ammon, you should watch Rocky IV.
I'll watch it. I watched last week. I missed Rocky IV, but only because I saw French Dispatch instead, which I think was basically the same movie, it sounds like.
It's the same movie. So
there was also a talking robot.
Ammon, are you – so, okay, you're a big Wes Anderson head.
Yeah.
That's the term, Wes Anderson head?
Wes Anderson head. Wes Andersini.
Okay, yeah. I assume do you have a – like much bigger than what's his name? The other Anderson.
That's a really tough call. My wife, I think, probably likes P.T. more than Wes. I probably like Wes more than P.T., but I love them both.
Hmm.
P.T., I think, is – you know, Wes's movies are all in some ways kind of the same. I love – it's a genre that I love. But the thing that I find amazing about P.T. Anderson is all of his movies are so radically different, and they're all masterpieces. So I like both of the Andersons.
Yeah, I guess I respect P.T. for that reason because, like, oh, this is a completely different thing. But also – I've always found myself kind of not seeing, like, you know, just kind of like going to the party and just not having as much fun at the party as everybody else seems to be having. You
know? That's fair.
Wes Anderson did Life Aquatic, right?
Yeah.
That's who we're talking about. Okay. So I think one of the greatest quotes from any movie ever is from that film when Bill Murray says he's going to kill the shark and someone says, "If that's the only shark of its species in the world, why would you kill it?" And then he, like, consults with, I don't know, Defoe, right? And then he comes back and says, "I'm going to find the shark, and I'll fight it, but I'll let it live."
See, it's just like Rocky IV.
That sounds a lot like Rocky IV, yeah.
Oh, man. All right. Well, we got to get into this, and our first movie is Funny Face, and I'll just give the lowdown. It cost $3 million to make. It lost $500,000. It only made back 2.5. But we are talking about, I think, a 59-year-old Fred Astaire and a 28-year-old. I must be getting the ages wrong.
She was 28. Yeah.
She was 28. I know. He was 29 years older than her. So maybe he's. What does that make him? 57.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he and I also saw he acted. He played the role in the original, which was from, like, the 1920s.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
The original was way different, though, right? I mean, like, they changed everything, right?
Yeah, so he was born in 1899, so yeah, he would have been, like, 58.
Yeah, wow. Makes sense.
Back when they filmed it.
John, I think this one's yours, right?
Yeah, okay, let's talk about Funny Face. So the thing is, Fred Astaire and Maggie, some other hotshot singer, dancer person, you know, they're under the guise of running a high-end fashion magazine. Maggie is in charge of everything, and he's like the photographer employee and everything. And she says, okay, you know what? I've decided what's big, hot librarians. So let's all go to the bookstore. Yeah, and let's do a shoot there, and, you know, let's see what magic happens from this hot librarian thing. And turns out there is a hot librarian, or, well, I guess, okay, technically not a hot librarian, but it's Audrey Hepburn as a shop girl, right? A bookshop girl. He's like, okay, you know what? I see something in her, and I think she's the face we need. You know, she's, like, she's the real deal. And so the magazine organization assaults and kidnaps Audrey Hepburn And
well, to be fair, they use false pretenses. So is that an assault or is it just a kidnapping?
All right, fair enough, Ammon. To be fair, false pretenses, then the assault, then the kidnapping. But anyway, that's what they do. And he's like, okay, you know what? You're going to be a star, baby. You're going to be a star. And she's like, okay, you know what? I don't really get into the shallowness of, you know, your whole high-end fashion magazine. I'm really into deep French philosophy, like empathicalism. I think empathicalism. And so they're like, okay, you know what? We're going to do a shoot in Paris. And she's like, oh, good. I can meet my idol there. So they all go to Paris, and they have a great time in Paris. And she's just not – her heart's not into the whole modeling thing, but her heart does slowly become, you know, entwined with Fred Astaire's heart, and she really likes him. But she has a chance to meet her idol, Flostra, the head of empathicalism. And turns out, you know what? The weird – creepy French guy with the French goatee who dresses all in black turns out to be a huge creep. And then that just confirms that she's like, maybe that's not the life for her. And so then she goes back with Fred Astaire. And that's pretty much what happens.
So she falls in love with him because he non-consensually kisses her, right? Which is what every girl wants.
Right. I don't know that that's why – I mean, he does do that. I don't know if that's why she falls in love with him.
It's not
to excuse it.
Well, right. She sings a whole song about it.
This is one of those weird hairy romantic things where it's like it's not excusable and it was wrong, but also, you know, I can kind of see how that's appealing, you know? Like when he says, you know, I kind of, what does he actually say? I put myself in your place and felt like you wanted to be kissed, which is a wrong thing to just assume what people think. But also, if that's what they think, then that is kind of a sweet gesture, if it's right.
And it's important, right, because that is apparently the – now, there's no such thing as empathicalism, right?
But I was going to ask. I didn't think
we were
going to
ask you that, yeah.
So far as I know, I've never heard of an empathicalist until I watched this movie.
Okay. No, that was going to be one of my big questions. Also, Ammon, I meant to preface the whole thing with this. Did you feel kind of personally attacked by this movie? Because I feel like French philosophy takes a really big hit, you know?
Yeah, philosophy loses.
Yeah, I mean, we often – whenever people are like, we need an older – like a creepy, sophisticated guy, let's make him a philosophy professor. That seems to be the good – and the thing is I would be like really offended if it were not so accurate to so many of my colleagues.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So you're the good one.
I think – look, a moment of seriousness. Like I think in the last 10 years there's been a huge reckoning with sexual harassment in the academy. But the reason why there's been that reckoning is because it's a huge problem. So
wow.
So, yeah.
So can I ask this, Ammon? Because this movie, it like starts out – the premise of this movie is that she's not just a face – She's into philosophy. She's smart, right? She's not your typical fashion girl. And like her whole thing is that philosophy matters and fashion's not a big deal. But whatever story we get at the end of this movie, this is one of the biggest fashion movies ever made, right? Like this movie is all about fashion. And it takes over. And I'm not complaining because she wears some really gorgeous dresses in this film.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, one of the – in terms of like all three of these movies I think were much more naturalistically filmed than the ones we watched last time, which is I guess not surprising given the change, the time periods. But the one sort of like art moment in these movies, right, is that when they transitioned from the – from her like modeling to like the still of the fashion shot.
Yeah.
A lot of those shots were really gorgeous. Like,
yeah.
Really beautiful, beautifully composed, beautifully put together. Yeah, so that was where the movie was much better on the fashion than the philosophy, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting because the fashion designer for this film is Edith Head, but also a lot of the dresses that she wears are from, I don't know how you say his name, Givenchy?
Yeah.
But so like
Givenchy?
This movie, I don't know how you say it. I just know that this movie started Audrey's relationship with him and like, she became the Givenchy girl instead of the Quality girl.
Oh, That's interesting. I did not know that.
We have to mention that the big thrust of the movie, the big artistic vision of the movie, is probably Richard Avedon. Right.
Right.
You know, because it's like he's the photographer. He's the, you know, the images of Audrey Hepburn are from his lens, and Fred Astaire's character is based on Richard Avedon, the photographer.
Isn't he even named Dick Avedon, or is he named Dick something else?
Dick Avery.
Just like thinly veiled, like this is about this photographer and this look.
Well, yeah, so the original one was about Richard Avedon and his wife, who was also his model, but I don't think was a sexy librarian, at least as far as
one of the big problems I have with this film, right, is that, like, the point of her character is to be smart and to be different than, like, what we think of as the fashion girls, right? But the lesson that's learned at the end, I think, is that philosophy isn't all it's cracked up to be, and the real happiness comes from getting married to the man who's older than your father, right?
Yeah.
And I will say, like, I hate the final scene. Like, them drifting off on the raft down the river is pretty ridiculous.
I
love that scene.
I was just thinking, wouldn't this movie kind of be, like, kind of, well, approaching great if just a few things were massaged out? Like, I kind of think the love story, I think it works better, like, platonically. Like, it's like, okay, you know what, I'm going to convince you you can do this other thing and you can expand your life and you don't have to narrow yourself into a philosophy that nobody likes. And I think – so I think two things. If I wanted to adjust this movie two ways, I would be like, you know what, you know, maybe they could have kind of a flirtation or a kiss or some kind of minor courtship, but she doesn't necessarily have to fall in love with him. But, you know, if he is the one who introduces her to a new life, and that where in you know, if you hate fashion, then that's one thing. You know, I kind of think the movie could do a better job of saying, hey, you know what, fashion has its appeal and its pleasure. And, you know, and you don't have to be closed-minded about it necessarily.
Yeah.
Also, philosophy isn't good just because it's philosophy. You know, like, it's not good just because it's, like, something that you can look down on something else about. But, you know, you can find just some jerk in philosophy. So if she went to Paris and she became a great model and she's like, okay, you know what, this isn't so bad – and also, if that empathicalism guy was a jerk, but she also found, like, a different philosophy, or someone her age, or someone, like, another suitor within philosophy that wasn't an empathicalist that opened her mind in a different direction as well as the fashion thing, I think that's where I think that would have just headed the movie in the right direction, you know?
So, I agree. I mean, not that anyone cared about this or this was something that they were concerned with, but, If Fred's character had maybe helped her to develop or express her independence, right, as opposed to just showing her that her silly ideas were silly,
So that raises the question: are we supposed to think that because Professor, what the hell is his name? I wrote
Foster.
It down. Foster.
Foster. Yeah.
Is an asshole. I'm sorry.
We just talked about this.
It's okay. They're in France. It's so your French is fine.
Is a bad man. Are we supposed to think that she should reject empathicalism because of that?
Well, that's what it feels like.
That
she right?
does. I thought she
that's what it feels
man.
Like. That he's like, see, your philosophy guy is a jerk. So
right, that's wrong. That's one of my least favorite things. Have you guys ever thought about how annoying Ocean's 11 is? Remember Ocean's 11?
It's awful.
The thing is, it's okay. There's a big thing about Ocean's 11 that I just hate, and that's like, okay, George Clooney, he gets out of prison and he's trying to woo back Julia Roberts, and she's like, no, I'm with a good man now, and it's Andy Garcia, and so George Clooney, and she's like, I don't like you because you're a thief, and so the whole movie George Clooney thieves and then sets Andy Garcia up to make a fool of himself and prove to Julie Roberts that Andy Garcia is a bad guy. And then at the end of the movie, Julie Roberts is just beaming at George Clooney, even though she hates thieves, or at least she says she does. But the whole point is, because Andy Garcia proved to be a bad guy, she's like, oh, this thief, this thing that I had this thing against, since he's the only other guy in the world, apparently, I'm going to be in love with this guy. And yep. I think movies tend to do that all the time, where it's like, if the guy proves the other guy wrong, then the girl has to wind up with this, with that guy.
So, well, that's in two of the three movies that we watched, right?
Yeah, yeah. Although I feel like, I have some other things to say about the second movie.
We can talk about that, Jagger.
Yeah.
But so I had a slightly different take on the because I think there is a connection between what she ends up liking about fashion and what she thinks she likes in empathicalism, right? And that's I think it's pretty explicit in the way that Dick gives her instructions, right? That because he'll always be like, okay, you have to imagine, you know, be this person who's doing X, Y, and Z in the scene. And so it's idea of putting yourself in the place of the person who does whatever. And supposedly that's kind of like her super weapon, right? Because unfairly, the funny, you know, the models at the beginning are all represented as incredibly vapid and stupid and therefore not able to do the job.
Yeah.
And ultimately it's her wit that allows her to be better at fashion than they are.
So her shoots are believable because of the empathicalism, right?
Yeah.
And he does support and nurture that, I guess, to an extent, right? He kind of nudges that along.
And I think, again, without endorsing or not endorsing their romantic relationship, I think that it's crucial because so he kisses her non-consensually in ways that are wrong, right? but there's also the whole bit with when she's in the wedding dress, right? And he's like, imagine that you're what's she supposed to imagine there? Imagine that you've just seen your
I can't remember. Like, it's because it's at the church.
Yeah.
I can't remember what he's supposed to make her imagine.
But that's where she falls in love with him.
Right, because it's in that moment she realizes that the person she's imagining is him, but that's because he's the person who's literally directing her. So leaving aside the morality of it, I mean, because it's an incredibly, you know, it's an incredibly sort of traditional, let's say, relationship. Formally, I think that really works. That works, right? It's like she's putting herself into the frame of this person, and she does it so successfully that she falls in love with the person who's her director, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what empathicalism would lead you to do.
Well, there you go. So now, there's a few things that this movie's really famous for, and one of them is the dance scene in the cafe, right?
Yes.
In her black outfit.
Which was bizarre. I did not love that.
It's bizarre. It's not my favorite. Like, I think there's better moments. I think, what's the actress that plays the why can't I think of her name?
The
Maggie Prescott.
Lady?
Bizazz. Yeah. The Bizazz girl. I thought that when her and Fred Astaire had their dance number at Floster's place, I thought maybe that might have been the best dance number.
The problem with that one is it veers very close to minstrelsy.
Yeah.
And so, which in 1957, I mean, you know, we can talk about the, you know, cultural relativism, historical relativism, but watching that in 2021, as good as the dancing was, I was very uncomfortable with that scene.
So I'm hoping that you guys took the time to watch the Gap ad that I posted for Audrey Hepburn, the Gap in Black Audrey Hepburn commercial. But
I did, because I remember that commercial. I remember being like, what is this Audrey Hepburn? What is the source material for this weird Audrey Hepburn dancing? And I want to be a part of it. And then 30 years later, I watched it.
So let's talk briefly about how old Fred Astaire is. So he's in his late 50s. Now there's some tips in this film that kind of, so like his belt is like a half an inch below his nipples, right? Mm,
that's the gauge for you, right?
that's
how old,
like,
someone is.
How
high their pants are
to your nipples. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So that's one of them. And there's not much they can do for him, right? Because you see the wrinkles in his face. But I think he's a fun guy. It seems like Fred Astaire would be fun to be around, right? And I think the same way about Gene Kelly too. I'm so especially yeah. when we watched the two girls from Rochefort, I thought, wow, Gene Kelly would be so much fun to spend time with. But so I guess he's got charisma and he's fun and he's nice and he's whatever. I don't know. It still just creeps me out. Like, it's really hard for me to watch this movie with him being more than double her age, and not double her age because she's 18 and he's 36, right? Like, I don't know. It feels severe to me.
Anyway. I want to say, I feel like somebody should come, like, rise to the defense of large age gaps in relationships.
Well, okay.
Hold my beer.
No, I'm kidding. I mean, like, to a certain degree, like, I don't think that it's inherently – it doesn't bother me inherently. I think a lot depends – for me, what people do consensually is
– yeah.
I really don't care about. And I think that there's lots of reasons why people might find meaning in all sorts of different relationships. What does bother me is power differentials.
Yeah.
Which often are associated, right?
I think what bothers me in this film, and it's hard to say if this is the case, because my understanding is that this wasn't a movie for him, and he said, go get me a hot young actress, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, they both signed on at the same time. They both signed on because they were told the other person signed on, and they wanted to do the movie together, right? But I think it's this Hollywood attitude where we see it, like, in movies like Sabrina, too, where Humphrey Bogart is in his 60s, but just like the expectation that he still at that age deserves a young co-star, right? And I think that really bothers me, that entitlement that no matter how old you get as an actor, then obviously you still, you know, your partner should be in
there. Yeah, I mean, I think that the acting point, I agree with you entirely. Like, I think that there's this, you know, as people point out, there's this incredible double standard. And there's this level of entitlement. Totally agree with those things. It doesn't bother me as much as a feature of the movies as it does about, as you're saying, the yeah. actors and the way that it's structured. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, Bogart ended up marrying
Lauren Bacall
after, and I think it was when they did Casablanca together.
No, so they didn't do Casablanca together.
To Have and Have Not.
That was To Have and Have Not.
Sorry.
Which is a great movie. I love To Have and Have Not. And I'm not sure what their age difference was at that point. But that's a great movie.
It was pronounced.
Yeah.
And they stayed together, you know, so they ended up, I think they stayed together for the rest of, well, his life.
Yeah, I think he died of cancer, didn't he? But I mean, he was pretty old.
20 or 30 years later. They were together for a very long time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, like that sense of that expectation is weird.
Yeah,
so definitely.
I think I agree with you as far as like what two people do, it's fine, as you know. And I think with Harold and Maude, we're going to talk about this a little bit more. Yeah. But I so.
Well, can I just say? This isn't like another defense of.
Yeah.
Of the age difference and everything, and I think it's fair that we can be critical about, like, okay, you know, there's the double standard in age and like what's expected, but also, I mean, maybe we shouldn't talk so much about an older man is expected to be with a younger woman because like somehow that's like more like they deserve it, like they're saying they deserve it as if a younger woman is better than an older woman, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think if one thing that this might say isn't so much that, like, okay, old men like young women, but it also says something like men and these are all stereotypes, of course, because we're just being really broad here, but, like, men don't have the maturity level, you know, for, like, women their own age. Like, this is that's what they're saying. Like, this Fred Astaire guy, it's like he is a nice guy and, you know, his character is a nice guy. But it is actually very natural for him to hit on Audrey Hepburn because, I mean, he's like this Arrested Development Peter Pan type.
You
know? It's like he's just like always young because he's like an immature, I guess.
I think the double standard that bothers me Hollywood-wise is you can have these older actors who get these young co-stars, but it's not like Audrey Hepburn at the age of 60 was acting with 25-year-old men.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's definitely there's definitely a double standard.
I mean, there's a double standard that I actually abide by because, I mean, I might say in our next movie, yeah, this is gross. I might say that. I'll just, like, spoiler alert, I just might say that.
Oh, so it's the first time I've ever watched Harold and Mudd. Is that the – no, Ammon talks about that one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought, what a sweet, innocent relationship. And then it gets to the scene. I was like, oh. Oh.
Well, I mean, something you guys are pointing to also, right, and this is a weird – this is, again, just a weird feature of our world, is that youth is a commodity, right? Mm-hmm. And that's bizarre and worth considering too. And again, I think in Shop Girl especially, that's going to be even more – well, actually, in Harold and Maude in a weird way too, it's pretty pronounced. Not so much in Funny Face, except for that she's a model who's selling her looks, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's the sense that one of the things that structures this and that's problematic, whatever we think of individual relationships, is the way in which we commodify, especially the youth of women, right, and not the youth of men. So yeah, I mean that's
now I feel left out. Yeah, I'm a young man. John, I want to be commodified.
John, we can sell your youth. We can bottle it. We'll make essence of John youth formula, youth tonic.
Okay, do it.
I'm not taking
$9.95.
That stuff. I still have more hair than John, so I'm not taking that stuff. So,
yeah, well, I'm shorter. I don't know.
That's true. All right. Well, you guys have anything else you want to say about Funny Face?
Maybe a little. I do want to get you guys' opinion on one of the numbers. I'm just a little bit curious. But there was I can't remember what the song is called, but Audrey Hepburn and Maggie. What's her name? I should really get Maggie's actor name, you know, because she deserves it because she's actually quite good.
It's called How to Be Lovely.
How to Be Lovely. Now, I took that as just seeping in sarcasm and irony. I don't think these two women were actually, you know, when they talk about, like, okay, fake it and smile and don't say how you actually feel. I thought it was completely sarcastic, but also the movie doesn't seem to address it afterward, so, like, so is that, like, a sincere thing? Is like, this, you know, this woman, this mentor figure telling her, it's like, no, you should actually feel this way, or is she saying, or is she commiserating with her? Because I kind of thought commiserating, but I kind of feel like maybe I was wrong.
So I in my comments, I posted the Annie Lennox Keep Young and Beautiful video, and I love that song, but my wife hates it, and I tried to, like, I think my wife understands that it's completely tongue-in-cheek because Annie Lennox, of all people, right, she's not, like, being serious with that song. But I think the way I read that number was that they were not taking it seriously, right? Like, they were being sarcastic. Like, they were, like, making that comment about fashion, right? So that's how I read it. And I think it's a lovely number, and I love their outfits in that number, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think irony, you know, irony and sarcasm are not always the same thing, right? So it's like, certainly the movie's taking an ironic stance on it. Are the characters taking an ironic stance on it? Hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think that Joe, Audrey Hepburn's character, actually sort of, I guess I read a little differently. I see her staying very true to sort of her, like, intellectual self. And so I think that she, like, she takes it with a grain of salt. It's like she's aware that that's part of the job, and she also remains her own person.
Maybe, but I mean, it could be seen. I mean, a lot of this is just, like, left unsaid on its face. I guess you could see it like, okay, she's being seduced away by the glitz and glamour of everything she, you know, everything she despised before. It's like, you know, she's turning into the cool mall girl now. But okay, I like how you say sarcasm is different than irony. So it's like the movie is saying one thing, are the characters saying one thing or not? I kind of think I'm not sure if, yeah, like any of those columns, like, because as far as I can tell, because the movie might be saying, it's like, okay, this is being ironic, they're not really meaning this, but at the same time the movie seems to be saying to me over and over again that philosophy is not good. Like, that's kind of the message I got from the movie. It's like, you know what, fashion is better than philosophy, is what it's saying.
I mean, now again, maybe it's just because I'm a fool. I did not take it that way. I took it that, like, the guy was a hypocrite, but, like, her commitment to, like, her intellectual life I don't think she gives that up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like what you said about, like, that her attitude and the philosophy she's had up to this point actually gave her something as someone in the fashion world that her peers did not have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
I'm also a big fan of Audrey Hepburn, so I'm going to always interpret her in the best light possible.
So, and it's interesting because I have my brother Ben and his wife Anne, right? And they're lovely. I love both of them, but she can't stand Audrey Hepburn films because it's always about her, like, needing to be rescued, right? But, like, there's always that relationship with a guy that falling in love with that guy ultimately solves her problems. So my sister-in-law hates Audrey Hepburn movies, but I love them. Almost every single one.
That's definitely Wait Until Dark is definitely that.
Oh, I love Wait
Until
Dark.
Alan Arkin is going to save her, right?
I don't think Alan Arkin saves her.
it might be different as a man watching Audrey Hepburn movies because, like, whenever I see an Audrey Hepburn movie, I can't help but think, I just wish I could save her. I wish I could be, you know, in a position, you know, because that's all I can hope for. You know, in itself, that's like kind of, that's a weird power that Audrey Hepburn has, you know. That she wants me to want to save her, but she may not actually need the saving. Yeah. And that's the trauma for us.
So Wait Until Dark, aside from being an Audrey Hepburn movie, like Alan Arkin's villain in that film is one of the greatest movie villains of all time. Like,
yeah.
He is so incredible in that movie, and it's lovable Alan Arkin, but
he's not so lovable there.
Not so lovable, no. But, so I fight with myself all the time over my favorite Audrey Hepburn movies, and Funny Face is right up there. But I think I'm probably stuck on her first one, Roman Holiday. But I love Audrey.
Roman Holidays are really. You guys did that one on your show, right?
We did, yeah.
Yes,
that's a good movie.
Yeah, we did.
There's
Roman
plenty
Holiday.
Of Audrey.
Yeah,
there's...
And Gregory Peck is how much older than her?
So that's a good question.
Not Fred Astaire levels, I don't think.
I don't think it was Fred Astaire levels. Let's see. I'll just pull up Roman Holiday real quick, and I can see both their ages.
To be fair, she doesn't marry him at the end of Roman Holiday.
So that's true. Now, while she's filming,
I hope no one
Funny
listening
Face,
has. I hope everyone's heard read. Or seen
you just
I'm
ruined Roman
that.
Holiday for everyone. So I think as soon as she finished Funny Face, she filmed a second film in Paris, right? Like, that's one of the reasons they went, because was it an afternoon in Paris with is it Holden, the guy who's also in Sabrina with her? And I think at that time she has an affair with Richard Holden.
I kid you.
Let's see. She's born in 1929. Gregory Peck is born in 1916. He's 13 years older.
Okay.
So maybe it's just that Gregory Peck always looks – he's always looked at least 55 since he was 30 or something.
Somehow Gregory Peck seems slightly creepier because Gregory Peck is an old, sophisticated man, like an Atticus Finch type. You don't want the Atticus Finch type hitting on Audrey Hepburn, but this weird, you know – fly-by-night bohemian photographer who is nearly 60 actually does seem a little bit more natural.
So we're going to get to Shop Girl, but the weird thing about, like, Steve Martin is he's looked like he was 50 since he was 25, but now that he's almost 70, he sort of still looks like he's 50.
Yeah, I don't think he's aged much at all.
Yeah.
But okay, so I've got one last question about Funny Face, and I know, Roy, it's one that you're invested in. Pizzazz or bazazz?
She says bazazz with a B, and it makes me so mad every time she says it.
I love it. Bazazz. Give him the old bazazz.
That
like,
might
I
make
know
an
what
award.
Is.
I feel like the judge in What's Up, Doc, when he says, stop saying that. Because, like, I want to be able to affect the movie.
Make him stop saying that. No, that's fine.
All right. Harold and Maude. Ammon, I think that movie's yours.
So I did not look up the box. I didn't know I was supposed to tell you guys the box office.
Oh,
cost.
You don't have to.
You're
not. Do you want to know?
That's Roy's job. He never does it.
Okay, so Harold and Maude cost $1.2 million, and it made $1,500. Like, I think it showed
that's
in
nice.
Two theaters or something. I don't know.
All the 70s box office stuff is like –
so
that's got to be inaccurate information. I feel like Harold and Maude, even at the time, was like – It was a Hal Ashby. He made Shampoo with Warren Beatty.
Cat Stevens, who's a star.
Yeah, and Cat Stevens was really big.
You mean
so
Yusuf.
I don't see how it was possible it could have only made less than $1 million. But
so, Ammon, you didn't take drama in high school, did you? I just know that Mr. Brower would be proud of all of us for watching Harold and Maude, and it's taken me this long to do it. Yeah.
Wait, to be clear, this was our first time for Harold and Maude, right?
My first time. Yeah. I've never seen it before. Yeah. Really?
Right. It's always passed me by. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. The Harold and Maude, someone said on one of my favorite podcasts, you know, a big Wes Anderson fan said, how can you be a Wes Anderson fan without seeing Harold and Maude? You know,
well, that's
that
a good,
kind
I mean,
of,
yeah, it's a good yeah. question. I never had seen it. I've seen bits of it. My wife is a big fan of it. And so, like, I've been, like, walking around doing stuff around the house while she watches it. And so I've seen parts of it, but I never sat down and watched all of it enough to understand what was going on, to the extent that one can understand what's going on in it.
So, okay, well, what's it about?
Okay, so Harold, we open up at a very beautiful home, I believe in the suburbs of L.A., but I wasn't exactly clear on that. But
I think it was Bay Area.
Yeah, okay. So somewhere in California, and then it's an enormous, you know, room. And what's that we see? We see a person getting ready to hang themselves, which they do. And then, but we don't see we don't see their fates. We just see a body getting ready to hang themselves, which they do. And while they're hanging there with their tongue lolling out, another woman comes in and we're going, oh, no, this is going to go wrong. But she just looks over and seems sort of disgusted and makes a remark and leaves. And ultimately what emerges is that this is young Harold Chasen. And who I think the actor was like 22, 23.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that neighborhood. And his mother, known in the movie as Mrs. Chasen, and this is apparently a common drama in their lives together. Harold is clearly obsessed with death. In fact, a lot of the movie is interspersed with his psychiatrist. And at one point, the psychiatrist asks him how many of these little performances he's put on, and he's not sure, but he guesses around 15. And we see him do like 4 or 5 of them over the course of the movie. Mm-hmm. So it's a very impressionistic movie, and I'm going to try to it's not exactly a linear plot, but I'm going to try to sort of put the main elements out there, and you guys going to add anything that I'm missing. So Mrs. Chasen is really sick of Harold's feckless nonsense, and although she, you know, sort of rolls her eyes and tolerates his weirdness and his obsession with death, she's starting to get frustrated. And so she's told him,
she's like Gowan's mom, isn't she? She's like Gowan's mom. I'm going to send the Green Knight. You know, you need to.
Yeah. The Green Knight here is an online dating service.
Yes.
Before the internet, right? But it's an advertisement dating service. It's a correspondence dating service. And so she fills out the form for herself in a truly lovely scene. It's unclear if she's filling out for herself or for Harold, but she works out these details and starts to arrange dates for him that he has to go on. But what Harold likes to do is not go on dates with women his own age or any age. What he likes to do is go to funerals. He drives his hearse to funerals, and he sits there and mourns. And as he's doing this, he starts to notice that there's this older woman in the back. She sure seems to be going to a lot of the funerals herself. And at one point she steals his hearse and tells him to get in, and they drive off together. She doesn't realize it's his car.
She's a Doors fan.
Yes, she is.
She steals cars. Drives to Morrison Hotel. Yeah. Yeah. She's a rider on the storm.
So they strike up this friendship based around their mutual interest in going to funerals. But they seem to go to funerals for very different reasons. For Harold, it seems to have to do with his obsession with death. For her, it seems to have something to do with some sort of celebration of life. But we start to see, you know, sort of her life. And so he's this very wealthy, sheltered child. And she's a bohemian. She lives in, like, a boxcar. She talks about her politics. I read, it's interesting, so about 2 weeks before this, I was reading this film professor who makes the claim that he's seen and sort of he's written the definitive book on every Holocaust movie. And he claims that this is a Holocaust movie.
Yeah.
Which we can talk about whether or not that's fair. But it does emerge at one point that she is a Holocaust. I mean, we never said, but we see that she's got a number of tattoos.
She's got the tattoo, yeah.
Or she's just quirky enough to get a Holocaust tattoo.
That's also possible. But she alludes to her past in Europe and to sort of having been both politically involved and persecuted, right? So we get this sense of this person. And then at a certain point, their friendship morphs into love. And they've fallen in love with one another. And at the same time, you know, so he's going on these dates, and the dates are just going worse and worse and worse. These very nice young women that his mother finds who are all, you know, getting interviewed, like, for a job, except for it's to date this weird scion of who knows what kind of wealth. And he can't even be, you know, bothered to sit down with them in a way that doesn't involve, like, some sort of horrifying show. Only one of the women actually ends up liking that, and that's a different story. But, you know, the dates are going nowhere. So ultimately his mother decides that instead she's going to send him off to join the army. Now, was Vietnam still going on during this? Because it kind of got an anti-war vibe at that moment, but I wasn't sure if that was...
1971, so...
So, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, right. So can I say, though, one of the dates, yeah. I feel like one of the dates had some serious potential. That actress who, like,
yeah, that's
also did the suicide with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why he didn't, like, hang out with her more. She seemed fun.
Yeah, I that's kind of a big problem I have with the movie. I feel like, as a person, I'll just say this really quick right now. As a person who, I'm not necessarily obsessed with death, but who is just, who doesn't have as much energy as those around him, and who isn't like very enthusiastic all the time, and, you know, who has his general low points and everything, I'm not turned around by someone who says, just live life, be happy, skip through a field, just because they're old.
Manic Pixie Dream Grandma?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Manic Pixie Dream Grandma is what she is. Like, and so, I mean, I was confused. Like, okay, like, he's this girl who's, like, really into his death reenactments, and he's just confused by that. I'm also not I'm kind of confused why he's not also confused by Maud as well.
Well, I think he's bewildered. Right? He's kind of bewildered by Maud, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, I think it takes a while to sort of warm up to her. Like, at first, he's like, "Why are you bothering me when I'm doing my funeral shtick?"
Yeah, I think
he's fascinated by her.
He
too.
Wants to be reminded about the curvature of the female form from Maud.
Well, yeah. So we do find out that she's a model for, what was the guy's name? Spartan? No, not Spartan. Gosh, shoot, what was his name?
Is his name Dick
Avedon? Dick Avedon. No, it was like Galateus or something. It was an amazing name. But yeah, so she does her own art. So she does the names of her paintings are things like The Rape of Rome and Leda and the Swan, a self-portrait, which I thought was really nice. But, you know, so anyway, the climax sort of comes. So he's supposed to join the army. His uncle is, like, a big soldier, but he doesn't want to. And so he and Maud arrange that he sort of seems to be so into it that even his uncle's like, he's sort of crazy to join the war. And at that point, he tells his mother, okay, I'm going to get married, but I'm going to marry Maud. And his mother freaks out about it. The priest freaks out about it. Everybody freaks out about it. His psychiatrist freaks out about it. And so, you know, after it's turned romantic, and then Harold announces that he is going to marry Maud, and you would think that everyone would be so excited because that's what his mother wanted, was to get married. But it turns out not to Maud. So the priest objects, and the uncle objects, and everybody objects in various degrees. But he goes and tells Maud, and she seems very touched, but she doesn't seem quite on board with it. And her 80th birthday is coming up. And we learn that on her 80th birthday, as they're celebrating and as they love each other in all the ways that one can love one another, she reveals that she's taken pills. And now Harold is at all these fake suicide attempts for suicide reenactments.
rushes her to the hospital, but it's too late, and so Maude passes away, and Harold is alone once again. That's the movie.
Harold, I mean, the final scene is Harold drives his Porsche hearse off a cliff, but not with himself inside it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, did you know that Maude was potentially going to be played by Greta Garbo?
You're kidding me.
That would have been like a completely different film.
Wow. How
yeah. Okay. You know, it would have been completely different. I think if this movie works, and that's up for debate. I'll just quickly reveal I'm not as big a fan of Harold as Maude as you know everyone else in the world probably, but I think Ruth Gordon's performance is one of the best parts of the movie, though. And,
absolutely.
You know, and so I kind of don't think, you know, whatever magic Harold and Maude has, I think it's with her, and I think they may have not dodged a bullet with you know Greta Garbo, but I think she makes the movie, you know, what it is.
Yeah.
The good thing it is, so.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine Greta Garbo was anything other than aging beauty, right? And like, I'm blanking on the name of the actress who you just said.
Ruth Gordon?
Yeah, for Ruth Gordon, that's not relevant to her performance. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't know anything about her when she was younger, and it's kind of not relevant. It's who she is right now that's like so crucial to the story.
Side thing, I don't know, this is sort of funny, but as far as I know, the only other movie I know Ruth Gordon is in is Rosemary's Baby.
Yes.
She's one of the aging Satanists in the building.
Yeah, she's the neighbor, right? She's the one who, like, helps to poison or to drug Rosemary, right?
Yeah. She's, like, the kindly, very similar character. You know, very bright, very grandmother on a great day kind of person, Ruth Gordon. good for her. Did either of you have a chance, because I only sent it a few hours ago, did either of you have a chance to read the Ebert review of Harold and Maude?
I started to, but I didn't get to finish it, but it looks like he did not love it.
Right. It just bottom line, yeah, 1.5 stars from our guy Raj on Harold and Maude. Like, and it was like contemporary. It was like he didn't know it was going to be, you know, some kind of cult classic movie. The review actually isn't terribly interesting, but it's just like one of those funny things that, you know, this big classic movie, this quirky movie, you know, with the Cat Stevens soundtrack and, you know, the one that everybody loves and that, you know, went on to inspire quirkiness, you know, into the 90s and now. Roger Ebert's just like, nope. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't a hit right away, right? Well, I guess we know that because it apparently made a $1,000.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose Harold and Maude, like, way ahead of its time. I kind of feel like Harold and Maude was one of those movies. It's amazing that none of us had seen it because at my time at BYU, I feel like it was, like, one of those things that interesting people were always like, yeah, Harold and Maude, it's my favorite movie. You know?
I could see that being a big BYU movie for some reason because it's quirky in that BYU way. It's not – it's edgy, but it's not, like – I mean, there's no sex. There's kind of sex, but not really.
Yeah.
Oh.
But not really.
So they intended to film a sex scene, and then the producers, I guess, talked the director out of it. So. I mean, he's old enough, right? He's like 22. The actor is 22. So.
Because sex happens in the movie, but it just seems like it just seems like that would just be just this. It would be this tone change that you just wouldn't be able to wrap your head around, you know? It's like, yeah, we recognize that it happens, but also don't film it.
So I think maybe Roger Ebert was just – I think – I don't know. Maybe he was just too upset at the idea of – what's the actor's name? Something Court.
Bud Cort. His name's Bud Cort. Cort.
Bud Cort's firm young body and Ruth Gordon's flabby buttocks. I don't know. So we talked about this while you were gone, Ammon, but every time he meets with his psychiatrist, they wear identical outfits, and I don't think either of us noticed that during the film.
Oh, I did not catch that, yeah.
Yeah.
That's really like, great.
Down it's, to like it, the ties and everything, yeah.
I think that's just – that's a really funny thing. I just – can you imagine like what you'd have to do to dress the same way as your psychiatrist? Like the, just how out of the way you'd have to go to troll like that.
Does he know his psychiatrist well enough, or does he like pay the psychiatrist to dress the same? Is it like scripted?
Yeah, I can only do these sessions if you wear this outfit I brought you.
I guess there are a number of theories. I think that's one of our unanswered questions, right? It's like, okay, why is that? Because my initial thought seeing that is he's a punk that likes playing tricks on people. It's the only thing that gives him life when he's not hanging around Maud. And so he just wants to annoy his psychiatrist by like maybe he like checks out his psychiatrist's office early in the day, and then he just goes out and purchases the exact same outfit as psychiatrist has. Just to bug
I think
him.
That's more plausible, yeah.
Yeah. But I JR, I like your idea that he's like, no, I will only talk to you if you wear the same thing I wear. That's the only way I'll open up.
So let me ask you guys what you make, because I don't know how this would have, you know, in some ways the 70s sensibility is, you know, we allow a lot more in our movies than they did then. I'm not sure you can make a movie with this many pretty realistic fake suicides. Did it jar you guys to watch that?
There was a lot of blood. That second one, man.
The second one was a bloodbath, yeah.
Yeah.
Which even the mother was like, I can't handle this.
Yeah, that was the breaking point of the mom. It's funny that you ask that, because you're right. It's like, okay, we're more likely to make light of suicide in the 70s than today. Like now, it's just like, you know, we kind of can't do that. And I think, you know, not that we're more enlightened now. I think, you know, this is this is always something I tend to think about. It's like, we know better now, but also movies now are strangely more meaningful to us.
Yeah.
And so we can't make light of big things now, whereas we could before, because you know, back in the 70s, as artful as the, you know, new Hollywood scene was and everything, they were still just movies, and they weren't our religion like they are now, in a sense.
There's less absurd. I feel like there's less absurdism in movies now, right? Like,
yeah.
I think that there was this sort of vocabulary of like, okay, Harold's doing all these things, but this is a ridiculous, this is not a realistic story. There's nothing about this that's like actually happening.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean we can have these sort of fairy tales now, but not with suicide. I think you're right. But it's kind of funny. Like I don't think we could successfully get the tone that this movie is going for now. It's, you know, maybe 10 years from now, you know, or maybe like back in the 90s we could. But I feel like there's no way we can make this without it seeming like it's poking fun of the relationship. There's this weird fine line where it's like, okay, no, this is a serious thing. We're not going to make fun of the fact that he's here. In fact, you know, we're going to have sympathy for him, and everybody who's questioning it are, you know, those are the bad guys. But I don't know if we could do that now without kind of winking a little bit. Like, can you believe this is happening?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point too, right? So it's like, on the one hand, as I think one of you already mentioned, I think Roy, you already mentioned this, this is the movie that makes the age difference, where, first of all, the age difference is much more pronounced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also the only one where the woman is older. But it's also the only one that really dwells on it a lot and talks about it a lot. But yeah, I think it's very sympathetic to it.
Yeah. It's again, it's more sympathetic than I can be to it.
So
I told you guys I was going to say this. I'll say it right now because we're officially talking about Harold and Maude. No, I do think it's gross. It's gross. Yeah,
it's pretty gross. I think the idea is like these two sort of soulmates, right? Like age has nothing to do with the person that you like really connect with, but I mean it's like this age difference is it's pretty severe. And if we're talking the actor and actress, I think it's like 55 years or 51 years, something like that.
Well, I think it's supposed to be even greater than that because she's turning 80.
Yeah, it's
and
supposed
he
to
can't be older than his early 20s.
I think he's playing 20. I think the character gap is 60 years.
Yeah, so that's quite large.
Yeah.
Right, but she's just like Hollywood. She's, you know, she's playing younger, which, whatever.
And he's playing younger too, right? So.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to ask, okay, so Roy, you said this is the ninth best, what is it, AFI top 10 romantic comedies, the ninth best romantic comedy of all time on AFI's list. I just want to, you know, look through this. Interestingly enough,
what's above that?
We have seen two more of these romantic comedies on this very podcast, Roy, if we're counting the Star Trek podcast. Yeah. One of those is one that we were discussing regarding Audrey Hepburn.
So you're what do you call it? Roman Holiday.
Yeah, Roman Holiday is number four.
Hmm.
Another one has her cousin in it.
Catherine. Yeah, you're talking about Philadelphia Story?
Philadelphia Story, number five.
I love that movie. But is that?
It doesn't feel like a romantic comedy.
To be honest.
Yeah, it doesn't. You're right. Ammon, sorry, what did you say?
I didn't know they were cousins.
I think
they are not cousins.
Fourth cousins.
Okay.
No, So
Philadelphia Story is definitely a romantic comedy. Is Roman Holiday?
Roman Holiday's not much of a comedy, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was sort of, I don't know, it was lighthearted like a comedy. Maybe it doesn't have, like, jokes, but isn't Roman Holiday, that's the one with the pajamas, isn't it?
The pajamas, where she says,
She doesn't sleep in her pajama bottoms, and then, like, when she wakes up in his bed, she checks to see if her pants are on.
Yeah,
that's a joke, right? That's a romantic
joke. I think so.
Joke.
Yeah, sure.
But
is this,
like,
a romantic comedy?
Yeah, I mean, yes, right? It's comedic, and I think there is a romance, right? So, I think so.
Yeah, I guess I don't. I think that something has to be more than comedic and have a, because I feel like a rom com is its own format, but maybe I'm just being. It is comedic. It's kind of an absurdist comedy.
Yeah,
and it's weirdly romantic, right? But
so, I mean, is it Moonlight Kingdom? Would you call that a romantic comedy?
Moonrise Kingdom.
Moonrise Kingdom. Yeah, you wouldn't, right?
No.
Yeah.
Moonstruck, I would call a romantic comedy. That's got
Moonstruck, number eight. Very good.
Oh, there you go.
Where's Moonlight on that list?
Moonlight is not a romantic.
That's not a romantic comedy.
Not funny.
Not funny. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant movie, by the way.
It is.
I only laughed like
five times.
Three times. Yeah. Okay. By the way, Sleepless in Seattle is number 10.
Okay.
Then Adam's Rib is number seven.
That's Adam's Rib.
And then number six is When Harry Met Sally, and then Philadelphia Story, Roman Holiday, and then It Happened One Night. And then number two, Annie Hall, the romantic comedy. So that, you know, that's a big romantic comedy, of course. And then number one, which I was very surprised, is City Lights, a movie I've never seen.
Oh, I love City Lights. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a Chaplin movie, if I'm familiar with my...
Yeah, you know. My son had to watch it for his high school film class, and he's like, it was a boring, silent movie. I'm like, no, City Lights, it's great.
I've actually never seen it either.
Very romantic.
Okay. Nice. Okay, well, anyway, Harold and Maude.
That was Harold and Maude.
She's quirky, and she left this life too soon because that was really rude of her to just leave Harold, you know, up in the air like that.
Yep.
She's lucky he didn't kill himself at the end of the movie. She's lucky, that's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah.
So, John, you did not like it? Or are we going to just...
I kind of didn't like Harold and Maude. It's just because... okay. For me, putting myself in place of Harold... And being a mopey kind of person that I tend to be, I found Maude twice as annoying as the rest of the world who you know, kept telling him to lighten up. Just the fact that she kind of told him to lighten up. I think if they were to – it's like she was so far the opposite that it wheeled all the way around kind of thing. And so I just kind of didn't – I didn't relate to that. If I were Harold, anyway. If I were Harold, I didn't relate to it.
Can I ask, and you don't have to answer this, but how do you feel about Manic Pixie Dream Girls in general?
I do like them. I mean, I can see the problem with them, for sure. But I don't like the idea that it's like, okay, if this person is set up to be someone who does not like life, and then this person who's so full of life just kind of makes him turn around.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, okay. And this is, and this might just be a me thing, but it's kind of similar to when, you know, if I'm moping and I'm frowning and someone comes up to me and just says, just smile, do cartwheels, do dancing. Or like if someone says, hey, let's just dance. Let me tell you, if I'm obsessed with death, the last thing I want to do is dance. And so I just don't find it believable that this person who's so full of life just turns him around like that, because it seems like, you know, his whole point is that he's latching onto the opposite of what she is.
Yeah. So I don't think it to me, it doesn't feel as forced as it feels like it is to you, right? And so I'm not going to invalidate your viewpoint, but she doesn't say do cartwheels. Like he says, I think I would like to do a somersault, and then she encourages it, right? And I mean, she is going to the funeral, so they do have that a little bit in common. But I think, like, it feels to me like his female contact for the last 20 years has been his mother.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that, and I understand the idea, right, of like, okay, if you're obsessed with death, it's someone just coming around and being all happy and manic, and it's going to turn it around. And I think I think he just kind of is taken with this really weird person. But to you, both of your point, this movie is basically a remake of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which, came first.
that's a really good point. I do really, really appreciate it. And, you know, maybe I'm just being – I guess this means I'm just being really, really shallow, I suppose, because I feel like with Kate Winslet, as annoying as she is – we talked about this,
and I had the same problem with that movie that I think you have with this one. I was like, I would not have been, like, turned around by Kate Winslet. I would have been driven crazy by Kate Winslet.
Yeah. And I think with me, and this is me being a guy, I suppose, it's like Kate Winslet is attractive enough, you know, that other aspect of my soul is turned around just a little bit. It's like I am attracted to this person, and so, you know, and so that is going to kind of, you know, undo my defenses a little bit. And so, I mean, I should give Maud more credit because, you know, she is light, and obviously, Harold is attracted to her. Like, he is attracted to her.
You have to assume so.
I'm not sure he's attracted to anybody, right? I think his love for her might be different. I mean, I guess ultimately he feels romantically and apparently and sexually, and I shouldn't say apparently, and sexually towards her, right? But it seems to stem very much from sort of his appraisal of her generally. Yeah, I mean, I hear what you guys are saying, and I totally agree that like that level of positivity can be obnoxious. I think that one thing that's interesting that makes it work for me to the extent that it does, and this shows up in, I think, Roy, you mentioning his relationship with his mom. So, you know, this is like very much a hippie counterculture movie, right? Like Harold is, it's got that anti-war vibe that a lot of late 60s, early 70s movies do. It's got that rejection of your parents vibe. And there's this weird sense in which Maude is from that same world, but 40 years earlier, right? Where she seems to have this Central European bohemian vibe.
Right. So it's like she's somewhere in time. About
the politics. And so it's like there's a sense in which they find this kinship in their rejection of convention that, even though they're different sort of in their like existential outlooks, is enough to sort of like connect them. Compared to his mother and his uncle and the priest and his therapist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what it comes down to is I suppose I don't really like this movie, but I also totally get that people are taken with this relationship.
Yep.
You know, so people with different personalities than I am, I cannot begrudge them for finding something in the relationship. Yeah.
So I don't know if you remember my grandma on my dad's side, Grandma Fillmore, but she used to be a lip kisser, right? Like, and I was never comfortable with it, but that was her thing.
Work if you can get it,
I guess, right? But so, like, I do, like, have that little bit of, like, a revulsion when it's like, right? And my mom is a lip kisser as well, and it's and maybe because my mom is now really old, it maybe that it is making it weirder. I don't know, but so anyway, all I wanted to do was reveal that I love kissing old women on the lips, apparently. So. So,
you know what, Roy, you, more power to you.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to subtitle this podcast The Quest to Go to Bed Before 12:30 in the Morning. So,
yeah. The goal is a half hour earlier than last time.
Are you guys ready to talk Shop Girl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shop Girl is about Clara Danes. What's her character's name? Mirabelle. What a lovely name. Mirabelle moves from Vermont to Los Angeles, which is a big mistake. People stay in Vermont. There's nothing in Los Angeles. You're moving to Hollywood solves no one's problem except for the slum lord that now controls your life. Anyway, Mirabelle moves to Hollywood. Somehow, she ends up working at Saks Fifth Avenue. She could have worked at that fancy sunglasses shop with Corey Feldman, but she didn't. She sells gloves.
How dare you?
Yeah. So she at the laundromat runs into Jeremy. He's not a good guy, but he gets her phone number and they go on a date, and it's not a good date.
Hang on. He's not a good guy?
There's an explicit line
in the movie where he says, "I'm an okay guy."
He's not a good person. I don't care. Well, let's just talk about him cuz so basically he evolves, right? But at the beginning of the movie, it's just really clear that he's not great. Like, his car he uses as a trash can, and he has to, like, move filth out of the way so she can sit down, right?
He has a lot of traits. I argue that he is a good guy.
Okay. Well, yeah,
like,
that's fine.
By nature, he is. By nature, he is. Like, by nature, some other people aren't.
So, he's not a good date. Right, he's not the kind of person that I would want my daughter at this age to get involved with, because he's not ready to get involved with anyone. Right, so they go on a date to the City Walk where he doesn't have any money, so they just watch people walking up and down the City Walk, and then they see a movie. But he has to borrow $2 from her. They get back to her house, and he just says, "Are you going to let me kiss you or what?" Right, and fortunately, I think she doesn't. Right,
that actually puts him in the better kind of predecessor.
But, I mean, eventually they enjoy each other's company, right? So one of the key things in this movie is she listens to this radio program where someone talks about the afterglow, which is the moment after physical intimacy where, like, there's supposed to be, like, an emotional bond forming. And instead of forming an emotional bond with her after they enjoyed each other's company, he gets really mad about how amps, right? Like, I guess, like, his job is he creates fonts for amps. That's his job. So anyway, she's not having a good experience with Jeremy, and that's when Ray Parker, is that his name?
Ray Porter.
Ray Parker Jr.?
Not Ray Parker Jr., the singer of the Ghostbusters theme song. No, not that guy.
Ray Porter shows up, buys some gloves from her, gives them to her as a gift, and asks her to go to dinner. He's much older than her. He actually acknowledges it. We'll get there. And they just kind of start this relationship where he's really rich, right? And as a logician, because logicians make gobs of money.
Well, we get where his money's really from, right? It's logic in the sense. It's like logic in the way that Mark Zuckerberg does logic.
Okay.
Right. Okay, yeah.
So he has houses all over the place, but when he's in L.A., he likes her company. And so he's treating her really well. She's swept off her feet. They enjoy each other's company. I do like that all of their scenes together are just like her facial expressions, as opposed to we don't have to see him naked. So that's the good news.
You think that has anything to do with the fact that Steve Martin also directed it?
Yeah. So
he wrote it. He didn't direct it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and there's something to talk about with, like, what is his intention with this film, right? Like, does he believe his own character? So after their first night together, he gives her the speech, which is the this isn't serious. I'm not, this isn't going anywhere, right? So he lays it out. And I want to say, like, are we supposed to give him credit for saying this is what this relationship is? I don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's a half credit.
That's a half credit.
Right? I mean,
so he says it, but then, like, everything that he does suggests that it's a lot more than that, right?
Yeah, so, like, emotionally he's pulling her in, but then he's got, like, this card that he can pull. Is like, well, remember when I said this wasn't serious? Right?
Yeah.
And so he has that dinner with the other lady that he enjoys her company later because she's really good with Thai culture, I guess, whatever. But he tells her that it's not serious because he's too old for her. So he's too old for a romantic relationship, but he's not too old for, like, just she's his while he's in town, like sexy lady, right? And so it's that kind of weird relationship. And she, like, tries to form a loving relationship with him, and it's just not what he wants. And he cheats on her, if you can call it that, right? Because he said this was going to be open, and he feels bad about it or whatever. But so they get back together after that, and she goes with him to New York, but she just can't do it. And she says, why won't you love me? And he says, I thought you understood what this relationship was. In the meantime, Jeremy's been riding around the country in a tour bus, and instead of listening to the rock and rolls, he's been listening to self-help tapes about relationships, right? And so at one point he calls her and he's like, got a book, and he's like, I realize now I objectified you, right? And so he's making some progress. He steals a suit. I assume he stole that suit from that guy in the band, the white suit, right?
I think the guy gives it to him because they're buddies.
He stole it.
Okay, fair enough.
All right. But then the next time you see him in his apartment, it's immaculate, right? So he's done some changing. He's growing up. And how fast you can change, I don't know, right? But so, like, when she finally realizes she can't be with Steve Martin, he has matured to the point where she can enjoy his quirkiness, I guess, without being totally turned off by how awful and immature he is. And now they're together, and the final one of the final scenes in the movie is that they are in afterglow position one, by the way. So I want to speak to the after.
I didn't notice that.
I want to speak to afterglow position one, and the thing is that human bodies are really warm, right? And so, like,
remind me what afterglow position one is.
It's like arms around each other after you've enjoyed the deed, okay. Right? Whatever, right? So because Steve Martin, I think, reaches afterglow position three, like, they're both laying on their back and he has his hand on her leg. That's, like, some contact. So I'm not a girl, and I tried to talk to my wife about this, like, is this a really important part of this? Because the movie says, and movies don't lie, that, like, lots of chemicals are being released and it's based on how accepted and loved you feel after, right? Not just during. Anyway, my wife says that seems to be the case. So the point I'm making is a really stupid one. Now it's science. The point I'm making is a really stupid one. So before I got married, I thought, we're going to go to sleep every night in each other's arms. And that lasted for a half a night because human bodies are hot. Not like she's hot, but like, holy cow, you can't do it. It's just too darn warm, right? So
says you.
You see it in the movies, but like, I can't even be touching my spouse when I'm trying to sleep. It's just too much body heat. So,
I mean, sleep is for sleep ultimately, right?
Yep. Yeah, we can snuggle. When it's over, there's a line down the middle of the mattress.
So you're saying it's a shame that she wound up with Jeremy instead of Steve Martin.
Because he's going to make her too hot.
Sleep better with Steve Martin when they're not just, like, just sweating.
Did you see how comfortable his bed looked? And those, like, 1,000 couch sheets.
Yeah, it really looked nice, yeah. I could be swayed by that.
So Steve Martin's character also, right, like, there's a part of him that he's not – it's not that he's ashamed that she's poor, but he refuses to go over to her house other than that one time, right? And she suggests it, and he just, like, deflects and comes up with a reason why he doesn't have to go back to her house, right?
So he doesn't like her wine. He spits it out.
Yeah.
He was really not cool.
Yeah, and then so at the end of the movie, like, as he does the narration, it's like, you know, okay, you don't know what you miss until you lose it, but also this kind of monologue about how she was able to find this relationship that finally works for her, and maybe he was a part of that. But I don't – so can you tell me, like, what is Steve Martin's point as the writer, and what's his character's position in this
film? I think that's a really good question. I mean, and apparently this was, like, a best-selling book before the movie. I remember – I vaguely remember him making it and it coming out.
I remember it coming out, yeah.
I never read it, though, but – because I think because I picked it up
Katie
and I was like,
says it's really good, by the way. So I well, okay wait I okay here's the thing. I kind of think, first of all, I think Steve Martin does a good job in it, because it's kind of interesting to see Steve Martin, you know, in something that he's usually not. At the same time, I think the casting of Steve Martin in this particular part was a big disservice, because we can't disconnect from the fact that he wrote Shop Girl, and so therefore he is inserting himself into this character. We can't help but do that. If you guys read the trivia, and I found this really, really interesting, Steve Martin apparently wanted Tom Hanks to play the role.
That would have been a much better casting, I think.
I think it would have been really cool, you know, for one, because, you know, Tom Hanks is a nice guy. You can see, you know, you can see how she could be interested in that. But at the same time, it would be so nice to see Tom Hanks in slightly more of a villainous role. But as far as, like, okay, let's just, like, remove ourselves from Steve Martin writing it and what he's saying. Within the movie, he says something at the end that, you know, maybe as the villain of the movie – we're not supposed to believe, and maybe I'm taking this very wrong, but, you know, when they meet again at the end and at the art thing, Steve Martin says, you know, pretty much for what it's worth, I was in love with you. And, you know, they're adults, and they just kind of like, okay, well, I'm with him now, and it's all for the best, and maybe it is all for the best. But I actually believe Steve Martin when he says that. And I think a lot of, like, the tension in this movie is that Steve Martin, when he says, okay, I just want this to be a sexual thing, and he tells his therapist that, and he tells her that, and he says all this stuff, I think he actually subconsciously doesn't believe that. And a lot of the problems of the movie is him actually acting out on his true feelings, which is, you know, he defined himself as a soulless man who wants, you know, this non-committal sex in all of these cities. But subconsciously, he actually is literally in love with her, and he can only say that to her after they're over, because he has defined the routine. He has defined his life as that.
So, but what's the point of him telling her that? Like, who does that benefit? Because
it only benefits us, the viewers, who get an insight into
it. Right, because it doesn't help her, because then she's now got this conflict of, because she was really attached to him, maybe in love with him, right? And now that she knows this, it I think it interferes with her prospects for happiness with Jeremy. And so I think it's self-serving for him to say that to her.
It might be, but also I think it is sort of a – I think it is a gift that like – puts her in a higher place, you know, than she may have considered herself at that time. He's like, you know what? I don't think he's saying it so much as a mind game kind of thing, or, you know, just, you know, I'm still in love with you or whatever, but telling her, hey, you know what? You may have all these conflicting emotions about this thing and the meaninglessness of it all, but let me just tell you, from my perspective, it does have meaning. And I think that would make her feel better.
Yeah. I don't think that he ever was saying it didn't have – I mean, because I don't see it as him ever saying that there was just a sexual relationship. I think he was willing to acknowledge it was a romantic relationship, just not an exclusive or committal or long-term romantic relationship, right? So in other words, like, I think that he wanted – he didn't just want sexy time. Like, he wanted, like, the girlfriend experience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he thought that he could have that without attaching more meaning to it than that. And she rightly recognized that they couldn't. And I think, yeah, so when he says at the end, like, oh, wow, I was really wrong about that, like, good for him, I suppose, to have that realization. But, like, that's the thing you share with your therapist, not the person whose heart you broke.
Yeah. Well, so what does he say at the end? Like, that he held her at a distance to avoid the situation that he's now in. Or I can't remember exactly the quote, right? But, well, let's see. I mean, here it is. How is it possible he thinks to miss a woman whom he kept at a distance so that when she was gone, he would not miss her? Only then does he realize that wanting part of her and not all of her had hurt them both, and how can he justify his actions except it was life? So, I don't think it would have been the end of the world if he had just been able to commit to a loving relationship with her if that's what he really wanted. So, is he just hurting himself, and is he going to continue to just have superficial relationships? I don't know. Here's the bottom line question. Is Ray Porter a bad guy? Is he a villain? Is he the villain?
He's the villain of the story. I don't know if he's a bad guy, but he's the villain of the story. He's not a good guy either.
Yeah. He's not. I think he's a regular guy who doesn't show valiance when it could have really counted, I suppose.
Yeah. And he refuses to eat sushi.
Can I ask you this? Did he, when he was buying the gloves, they were always for her?
That's what I assume. So did he come into the shop to find a young girl? Because did he know she worked there?
I think he was probably browsing, and then he was like, hey.
Other older men were coming into the shop and hitting on young clerks, right?
Yeah.
Was that what he was doing? He was just coming in to find a young girl?
Yes.
I think he must have been. The world is oyster.
Yeah, sorry, Ammon, what did you say that last part?
Sorry, I was just saying that I think he regarded the world as his oyster. So did he go there to do that, or is it just that anywhere he goes, that's a possibility?
Maybe. This was one of my questions I had at the end, so I guess I'll just ask it now. Because she asks, why did you choose me? And he doesn't answer, and so I don't know, like... I think he must have been looking for something a little bit more shallow. Maybe actually the girlfriend experience. I guess he just didn't anticipate actually getting a girlfriend out of it.
So it seems like if he was going all in on shallowness, he should have maybe gone for that blonde girl that works at the store, right?
See, and I guess that's the big question. Why did he go for Maribel rather than Lisa? And yeah. I think it might have something to do with a little bit like it's almost like he wants to recreate a movie experience. He wanted to get the Audrey Hepburn rather than the Marilyn Monroe kind of thing, maybe. You know, because it's like that's what would be expected in the movie experience. And also I think possibly – okay, and this is getting creepier and creepier. It like has to be creepy. You know, in order to do this, if that's what he did, I also imagine he probably went in and he saw how much attention all the other counter girls were getting, and he may have been more attracted to the one who was getting very little attention, because he felt like he might have a better success rate at someone who was more left alone.
he was slumming it a little bit to increase his odds. Is that what you're saying? So Clara Danes.
Well, no, because it's. I mean, let's just be honest and shallow and just like okay.
No, sure. She's not gorgeous. She's lovely, but she's not like a drop dead gorgeous person.
If you see two counters and you see I have her now. You see Claire Danes at one counter, and then you see Bridget Wilson Sampras at the other counter. You're probably more immediately drawn to Bridget Wilson Sampras because she shows cleavage and you know she has the big blonde hair and she's like really outgoing and so she demands that kind of attention.
If you take a moment,
you'll be like, I am more attracted to Claire Danes for sure.
Yeah.
What if there's a third counter with an 80-year-old Greta Garbo?
That's a no-brainer then.
Well, you're drawn to the person who just wants to be left alone, which is
okay. Yeah. All right.
I think that you guys, I think that like there's he's got some sort of aesthetic game that he's playing, wherein that's the more interesting choice, right? Mm-hmm. It could be that he has a glove fetish.
That's what I thought, because she does wear it during one of their sleepovers, right?
And I'm like,
Yeah.
Also, you know, could have been a huge fan of My So-Called Life, which many of us were.
Many were. But also, and I think if he is doing – if he is playing this game, he probably feels less shallow himself, you know. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm doing this thing and, you know, I have this power and I'm able to do this. But I'm not going to be one of those old creepy guys who goes after the busty blonde girl, you know, that, like his peers probably do.
I think he thinks of himself as a good guy because he's told the story where, you know, so he's giving her a thing that she, like, seems like a very kind, that he's never mean to her, right? Like, they enjoy one another's company. So he sees him, I think that all that allows him to see him, you know, he's giving a certain kind of experience, and I think he thinks to himself, because I've already established the parameters, it's nothing but a positive thing for both of us. And,
yeah.
I mean, I think it's unrealistic of him to tell himself that story. I think it's self-serving of him to tell himself that story. But that's a story that fits with this, even sort of in the demeanor of Claire Danes and Bridget Wilson's Ampress. It's a story in which Claire Danes makes a much more likely candidate, let's say.
Yeah. In his little narrative. Okay. Now, okay, let's switch gears a little bit, because I want to talk a little bit about Jeremy and why
how much he sucks.
I like Jeremy. I think because here's the thing. I think the movie talks. There's a little bit of difference between age and maturity. To an extent, because different aspects of maturity, because obviously Ray is much more of a mature person than Jeremy in so many ways, because he knows how to treat, you know, Mirabelle. Like, he knows how to treat her. Thing about Jeremy that kind of makes him genuine is even that he's an idiot and he's a slob and he's inconsiderate and all of those things. But like when he first meets Claire Danes at the laundromat, and he chats her up. I got the sense that he wasn't chatting her up like a creep. Like, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't prowling her, that, like, his, you know, his friendly banter with her was very genuine. And I think the big key thing is the type of person Jeremy is he listens to these self-help things about, you know, how to treat other people and, you know, understanding them and doing all this stuff. Many guys, most guys, maybe in their 20s, if they did come across that information, would actually use that information to manipulate Claire Danes. And I think his sincere motivation was to come clean, because he literally was realizing this. And it wasn't him, saying, it's like, okay, I think I understand what I've done to you now, is straightforward that. And it wasn't a chance for him. For him to be like, oh, I didn't get her, you know, she didn't become my girlfriend for this reason, and so I'm going to employ these things so I can get her as a girlfriend. I don't think that was his motivation at all.
No, I agree. I think he's genuinely trying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree too. I think that where he ends up is as a much more decent person.
Yeah.
But I think at the beginning he just sucks.
So can I? Yeah. But he's also kind of us, right? Because, like, what chance do we stand with a girl who's being swept off her feet by Ray Porter, right? Because we're pretty sucky. But so what is the point of adding the story of the mistaken identity where he ends up with the blonde girl? Is that just brief comedic effect? Because that really doesn't affect the plot at all.
You know, it's funny. Today I listened to a podcast where they talked about Shop Girl, and they really liked the movie, but they really hated that scene for exactly what you're saying. Like, it kind of is pointless except for, just a farcical comedic sidebar sort of thing.
Yeah. I just don't understand what it's trying to, like, advance. Is it showing that, like, maybe he's matured, but he's not all the way there yet. Right.
So I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, but, you know, he's not with Mirabelle.
He's not with her. There's no obligation, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Anyway. Yeah,
it seemed very... I mean, one of the things that I was curious about is that I think we're supposed to get set up for is Ray, who has... Wait, I forgot. Is his name Ray? His name's Ray, yeah.
Yeah.
Is Ray, who is supposedly contrite, going to stay with Claire Danes now that he said, oh yeah, I really shouldn't have cheated on you, that wasn't cool? Or is he going to go for Lisa when Lisa's throwing herself at him? And but of course, the point is that that question is never even raised. And so it's a giant red herring, but that sets her up for an actual realization, right? Because then when she realizes, when she says, you know, I can be happy, I can be unhappy now or later, you know, we didn't see the answer to that either. So the fact that Jeremy had sort of, you know, led her on this false goose chase inadvertently means that Claire Danes is able to have this encounter, right? And is able to have this sort of more meaningful breakup with Ray. Where it's not like, oh, I proved myself by not sleeping with her, or, oh, yeah, I slept with her, too. So I think structurally it works. I mean, I still think it's kind of... I mean, I'm never invested in either Ray or Jeremy, so it's hard for me to care. But
it's okay, so that was going to be my next question. Like, who should she have ended up with? Should she have ended up with nobody?
Yeah, I'm not. I mean,
Jeremy seems fine at the end.
Yeah, yeah, I'm okay with her ending up with Jeremy. I would like to. I mean, so because I believe in Jeremy's. I believe in everyone's ability to change. Right. I'm trying so hard to be willing to let people who maybe aren't great get better, and I'm including myself in that as well. Right. Like I believe a lot of stuff that's wrong, and I'm going to find out and hopefully I change and I'm a better person. And so I believe in Jeremy's ability to change. So I can handle that.
I think that's kind of the, like, his one attractive thing is that, and that, like, Steve Martin, as old as he is, I think, like, he will never change who he is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he kind of made his decision on what the relationship was, and he never budged from that. Whereas, you know, Jeremy is like, okay, you know what? I suppose the sky's the limit for Jeremy, because, like, if that's the one thing you can do and you can't do anything else, well, that's a pretty good position to be, because you can change for the better in every situation. Yeah. So
is Jeremy a manic pixie dream boy?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think I don't think, like, she responded to him that way, right? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, like, at the very end, he becomes that because that's exactly, you know, what is needed for her. So I guess that makes sense.
Hmm.
I think that he is at the beginning, and we just tolerate it differently from women and men.
Like, she's just kind of this annoying person, you know, she's a slob at home. She's like, whatever, but let's have sex, you know? So that would be a Manny Pixie dream girl.
Mm, okay.
I could see that.
All right. Are you guys ready to do some awards?
Me.
Oh, I got one last complaint about Shop Girl.
Okay.
And it's, what's up with, it's back to dissing on philosophers, right? Like, he's a logician who's made it big as a computer guy, but, like, he calls himself a logician. And he's a creep too. Sorry, I just had to get that out.
So we have explored the seedy underbelly of philosophers.
Oh, and Steve Martin was a philosophy major. I know this because we always include him on our brochures. See?
All right. All right. Well, now we're doing. Now we're definitely doing some awards.
All right.
You guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Ammon, since I'm in charge, I do this in a different order than John, but I'm sure we'll all be just fine. So, Ammon, what's your favorite title?
Harold and Maude. None of them are great, but that's my favorite.
All right, John, what do you got?
I agree, because it is straightforward. That's what it is. But I kind of have problems with the other two. I'm like, those aren't what they are, kind of.
Well, I'm going with Funny Face. And by the way, we didn't mention it, but that the photo of her, the negative space photo, I like that. So, all right. Well, then, John, what's your favorite movie poster?
Favorite movie poster? I'm going to go with Funny Face, where it's, you know, her face and then the silhouette of herself. Well, not a silhouette, but just her in that black uni, you know, kind of silhouetting her face itself.
Silhouetting?
Silhouetting, yeah.
All right, Hammond, what's your favorite movie poster?
Yeah, I mean, both for design reasons and just as a giant fan of Audrey Hepburn, Funny Face is the best poster by far.
Yay. So best tagline from these posters, and I'm going to go first because I chose presented in a real new dimension from Funny Face.
Okay, my tagline, I went with relationships don't always fit like a glove.
Mm.
For Funny Face.
No, that wasn't.
All right. Yeah, that was my favorite tagline too. I thought it was a really nice choice of the director to make a O.J. Simpson reference in what was otherwise a pretty sort of psychologically crushing movie.
Okay. Oh man. All right. Alternate taglines. Ammon, give us your new taglines.
Okay. So for Funny Face, it's if by funny you mean perfect.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
I do not understand why she goes, I have such a funny face.
No, she's gorgeous. Audrey Hepburn's gorgeous.
Yeah. Okay, so Harold Mott, wait, so is it a Holocaust film? And then Shop Girl, I admit this one's a little bit of a puzzler. The discreet harm of the bourgeoisie.
Discreet charm of the you do a thing with it.
There we go.
Okay. All right. My tagline for Funny Girl is French philosophy's got nothing on the depth of a New York City high fashion. For Harold and Maude, I said, look, if you just average out the ages, it's not that gross. And then for Shop Girl, I have, for Mirabelle, there's only one thing worse than men her own age.
All right. So for Funny Face, I put Audrey is back in black, and that's okay. I'm disappointed.
Oh, that's good.
Harold and Maude, you will love her flabby buttocks. For Shop Girl, I put, don't worry, Steve Martin doesn't get nude. So, all right. Your favorite opening credits. What do you think, John?
Oh, well, the Funny Face, they have the negative magazine proof machine thing with
it's
the photos
clever.
Running through it. Yeah.
What about you, Ammon?
Yeah, I mean, stylistically, that was interesting. I'm not enough of a fan of Cat Stevens to care about the Harold Mott opening.
Funny you should mention that.
The opening was pretty boring.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Cat Stevens, and so I'm going to go with Harold and Mott, and I had no idea that there was any Cat Stevens to be had in this film, but there
what?
Is, if anything,
so
an overabundance of Cat Stevens in this film. So
that's like the most famous thing about Harold and Maude.
It's
weird that we haven't talked about Cat Stevens.
I literally knew nothing about Harold and Maude, and so like as soon as the opening credits, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's a Cat Stevens song. So yeah, plus I thought it was clever, like him setting up his suicide and you don't see his face. I thought it was good. Anyway, best titular. What's that?
It was artfully done. Yeah. And I do like Cat Stevens. I just don't love Cat Stevens. So
do you like Yusuf?
I was like, oh, it's got the guy who now is Yusuf Islam. That's what it was. Yeah.
So wasn't he on a flight that was diverted because he was on the watch list?
Was he?
Yeah, like he was flying to New York and they diverted to Maine because I guess Maine would be able to handle his terrorist act and New York couldn't.
His terrorist guitar.
Yeah. All right, titular line, Jonathan.
Titular line. Well, I think it's when Fred Astaire says or sings something about her face being perfectly funny.
He does say, I'd love your sunny, funny face.
Sunny, funny face. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I think that was it, which I'm counting as titular line.
Sure. What do you got, Ammon?
Well, if the movie had ended the way I would have liked, it would have ended with them saying, "I now pronounce you Harold and Maude." But since it didn't, that doesn't count. Okay. So I'm also going to have a funny face, but I'm going to have them. She goes, "How can I be a model? I have no illusions about my looks. I think my face is funny."
That's,
it's not quite a funny face, but I hope you guys let me count it.
We can count it.
I like "I now pronounce you Harold and Maude."
Okay, so I went with "I love your funny face" because that's the one they actually used. So what can you do? Technology. There's some fun technology. Yeah. Ammon.
Using a baggie as a condom.
Oh. So that's like.
Doesn't let him do it.
So like.
That doesn't work.
So he was an awful person. Like that scene is like where he's the rock bottom awful person, right?
Oh, yeah. Borrowing from the neighbor. Like that's. Yeah, that was, he was pathetic. But yeah, like the baggie's a condom. Public safety announcement. Don't do that.
That doesn't work. Yeah. Okay. All right. But what about you, John?
Okay. I'm going to pick. I think I know what you're going to pick. So I'm going to pick this one. In Harold and Maude, the smell device.
Yeah, I picked that one.
That is what you pick? Okay. Yeah. Well, if you pick that one, then I'm going to pick the saluting machine.
The saluting arm.
The arm flap salute, on the army guy's uniform,
but
the smelling device, I don't get what that is. You twist a bunch of dials and it makes, and you put a mask over your face and it's like, oh, I'm smelling rubber or something.
Yeah, I guess an odorifics machine is what she called it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, John, what's your favorite name from these films?
Favorite name? I'm gonna go with. Okay, first of all, I think. The famous Utah Jazz basketballer was named after Audrey Hepburn's character, which is Jaw Stockton, right?
I think you're right. Okay.
Yeah, so
not John Crotty.
Yeah. No. One of the actors' names in Funny Face is Iphigenie Castiglione. That's a great name.
That
yeah.
sounds very
Castiglione.
Exciting. Yeah.
Sorry. It's a beautiful name. Yeah.
It is good.
All right. So, Ammon, what do you got for your favorite name?
Professor Emil Flostry.
Okay. So, Sunshine is her name, but the mother calls her Starlight. And I think she says, name's Sunshine. He's like, that's too bad. So, my name is Starlight. I went with that.
Okay.
That would have been a great name. What's your favorite food? Mine is in someone's pocket and it's been getting warm for a while. But go ahead, Ammon.
So the shop girl had a lot of food scenes. The one that really spoke to me the most, though, was the one that our friend Ray did not like. That's when they're having the cha-cha-cha restaurant, and they're having jerk chicken.
Great. Yeah. Mm.
And cha-cha-cha restaurant just looked like a classy joint.
I went with Jeremy's stay-at-home date food, which was fries in a bag where the bag is now see-through.
The translucent bag.
The translucent bag of fries, which is like, that's a good sign that you're going to get some good greasy fries. Jeez. So, yeah.
So, Maude offered Harold some licorice. So, I assume she's just got licorice in her pocket. So, he said no. Okay, your favorite outfit, John.
Outfit. Okay. So Funny Face was all about fashion and everything. So I feel bad that I'm not picking something for Funny Face, but I'm picking the dress that Steve Martin buys Claire Danes that's cotton and orange. And it's like the flowery orange cotton dress, and it looks so comfortable and so pretty.
Is that the one where her workmate like does the snooping about, did you just sell this dress?
No, that was a different dress.
That was a different dress.
That
okay.
That was the white flower dress.
Okay.
Which it looks a little bit more form fitted and whatever, but less cottony. Yeah.
Less cottony.
Just really seemed to hug.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. All right, Ammon, what's your favorite outfit?
So I did go similarly. I was like, I really wanted to pick Funny Face because there's so many great outfits in it, but I also went with a Claire Danes dress. But I went with the one that made the perfume girl jealous. That Steve Martin bought, but it's a tie because I also, and I'm sorry to say this, really liked the outfit that the perfume girl wears when she seeks to get revenge with what she believes is Ray, but is actually Jeremy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I did go with Funny Face, and I decided the fishing shoot outfit, which is in that cute little outfit fishing. Anyway. Okay.
That's right. Were they fishing in the Seine?
Uh-huh. Yes, they were.
Yeah.
All right. Your favorite alien, Ammon?
The Tallahassans.
Okay. Very good. What about you, John?
Tallahassans is better, but also in Paris. Audrey in Paris. She's like, she is a stranger there.
So that car they drive around in, I think it's called a Vellum. I'm assuming that that's an alien spacecraft. So I'm giving it to the car.
The car.
That's fair.
That's a Vellum. That's a pretty cool car. I wonder if you can pick one of those up these days. I would love to have one of those.
All right. John, your favorite special effect?
When Steve Martin and Claire Danes are hanging out in his in his living room or something, and he's looking through the binoculars, and he sees, and then Claire Danes he points out Claire Danes' place, and so then he sees Jeremy right close up. I think it was special effect that those binoculars are so powerful.
Yeah, those are crazy strong binoculars.
Yeah.
All right, Ammon.
She could see Jeremy putting his hand down.
On a date with himself?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like that's usually not as powerful as, up in the hills of.
At that moment, was she like, and this is what I'm missing? Right? Yeah.
He might have been very gentle with himself. We don't know.
Yeah, maybe
it looked like
he's a sensitive, gentle self-lover.
Gentle, caring date. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Ammon.
The effect of the movie scene turning into a camera still and funny face when they're doing the shoots.
Oh yeah.
That was a very sort of lightly done but very artful effect that made them that felt perfect for the movie.
Mm. I'm gonna go with Harold cutting off his hand for one of his dates.
That was a good one too.
All right, your favorite location, Ammon?
Favorite location? I love the Greeks. I got to go with the statue of Nike at the Louvre.
Hmm.
Or people also know her as Victory.
Yeah. Man, it's hard to beat Paris. John, what do you got?
Just Paris in general. But, I mean, if I want to be specific, I think, the the empathic part of Paris, where, her Paris philosophy club, I think.
Okay. So,
I think I've been to that part of Paris, to be fair, and it is really lovely.
So I went with Vermont. I think Vermont would be lovely. We only see her there briefly, but it's nice and snowy. So yeah.
Anyway. I've never been to Vermont. It's one of the few states I've never been to.
Yeah. So me neither. And I thought I had, but there's no way I have. So North Dakota and Vermont are the two that I have not been to.
They are two of the five that I have not been to. So I've been very close to Vermont. I've been within 20 miles, but never quite.
Yeah. New Hampshire's lovely and Maine's even prettier. So I imagine Vermont is just right up there.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Best song, Ammon.
So I do like Cat Stevens somewhat. Wild World.
I don't think that was in this World movie.
It was too.
It definitely was not.
I swear to God it was.
Okay, well, I'll help you out. My favorite Cat Stevens song on this soundtrack was Don't Be Shy, which he wrote for the movie.
Oh. Are you sure? All right. That's now mine too.
Okay.
All right. I go with Bonjour Paris.
That was delightful, wasn't it? Okay. Yeah. So, your favorite guest star, John?
Okay, Tom Skerritt as the mustachioed motorcycle cop who gets his bike stolen.
That is exactly what I chose also.
Oh, nice. Good for you guys. So,
so excited to see Tom Skerritt.
So, I picked Cat Stevens because not just because of the music, but he's in it. He's at one of the funerals.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. All right. External recurring character. I'm just going to go with Audrey Hepburn. But go ahead, Ammon.
What else have you guys had her in?
We watched Roman Holiday. We watched Robin and Marion.
Yeah.
And we watched Wait Until Dark.
Okay. So I'm going with Frances Conroy.
Whoa.
So I am a big fan of Six Feet Under. Are either of you guys Six Feet Under fans?
I've never seen it.
I've seen the first episode.
Okay, but the mother in it, Ruth, is Mirabelle's mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Vermont. And she's also in Crimes and Misdemeanors when Judah is having his big breakdown and he goes to his childhood home. She's the woman who owns the childhood home.
Oh, gosh. Whoa.
Wow, good work.
Man. Wow. I had no idea.
Wow.
I'm a big fan of 6 Feet Under, so I was excited to see her. So.
That's good. Okay. I went with... Wait, external recurring character. Yeah. Let's see. There's this movie called Three Amigos, and Steve Martin's in it.
There was some low-hanging fruit. Okay.
Oh, I was going to say that Francis Conroy is also in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, so that's like a one degree there. But
oh, wow.
That would be a fun one to talk about.
Did either of you guys, because I kind of, one of the ways that I was able to enjoy Shop Girl more is that I pretended that it was just Rubric having grown up.
Oh, I love that movie so much. Okay. yeah, it's too bad they didn't have a scene where they were at his house and he just peed at the table. So, okay. John, internal recurring character.
I went with buying clothing for your trophy lover.
Okay, what do you got, Ammon?
Shop Girls.
Shop Girls. Oh, yeah, she's a bookshop girl, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I went with off-screen sexiness, and thank heavens, because no one wanted to see any of that. So I don't know. Maybe Steve Martin does push-ups. Okay. Your best death, Ammon.
So I think that the only actual death in any of them was Maude. But my favorite death was Sunshine's stage death.
Yeah, that's mine, too. That was great. What do you got, John?
I went with... Fred Astaire, roughly 6 hours after the movie Funny Face ended. Because it would have been, kind of their wedding night, really. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, there's no way his heart could handle that. So, all right. Villain, Ammon.
I wanted to say Ray because I do not like him at all, but I went with Professor Emile Flostre.
Okay. What's yours, John?
I don't know. I thought about I'll tell you what I thought about later. I'm not going to say it alive. I'm going to go with the priest that tries to talk Harold out of his relationship with Maude because his body is too taut.
His young, firm, taut body. His glistening body. That was pretty creepy. So I honorable mentioned L.A., but I went with Harold's racist army uncle.
Yeah.
All the slant-eyed girls you can handle.
That dude was incredible.
Yeah. Okay, hero, Ammon.
There are not a lot of heroes in any of the movies. I think it's only the women in all the movies who are heroes.
Yeah.
And my favorite of them was Maude.
Okay, very good. What do you think, John?
Because she achieved her quest of killing herself.
Yes.
She finished her hero's journey well, right? She lived a life worth living and died a life that died the death she wanted.
Yep.
Okay, well, I went with Jeremy because he began his hero's journey.
There you go.
Nice.
So I went with producers that decided to not show naked old people. They're my heroes. By the way, I had
this is all of our futures.
Just I know. I close my eyes when I take a shower these days. Okay, right. So I don't know. Did any of you guys take cooking in high school? Like my senior year, I had to take a throwaway class, and it was cooking. And in that class, we watched a nutrition video that showed a naked 60-year-old woman because it was talking about the effects of aging on your skin. And I was like, there was no preparation for that. She just hit play on the video, and there it was. So
I didn't take that. I actually wished one of my regrets is that I didn't take cooking in high school. And it's funny that I say that now with the rest of your story, but it's true. I wish I had taken cooking in high school.
So not quite as old, but I also got to watch the home video of is it Abbott, Mrs. Abbott giving birth as part of a lesson in anatomy.
I don't think you would allow that anymore.
Right. Yeah, there's no way they'd allow it anymore, but we sure saw it.
That's a mighty big flex from Mrs. Abbott, your high school teacher, to bring in her own birth.
She's gonna be like, this podcast is gonna get her arrested.
Yeah. All right. Okay, let's see. We are on to movie goof. John, what do you got?
Okay. This is a goof in editing. And that's when it shows Harold floating in the pool, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And then it cuts to his mother getting into the pool and then swimming, and the camera pans down and she swims past his floating body. That would have been an extremely funny scene if it didn't show Harold floating to set the scene up. If she just got into the water and then she's swimming and she passes him as he's floating.
So that wasn't a goof so much as notes that you have for the director.
An editing goof.
Okay. Yeah. All right, Ammon, you got a good movie goof?
Yeah, so there's a whole scene where the director of Shop Girl forgot that Schwartzman's character was named Jeremy, and he thought that he was named Ray. This went on for a whole scene.
Oh, yeah.
Wrong person sleeping together. It was a real mess, and I don't know why they didn't catch that.
It was a whole scene. Yeah, that's true. That's funny.
Yeah, I can't believe that. That stayed in the movie somehow. So, yeah. For some real movie goofs, I believe Audrey Hepburn flees the shoot late at night in despair because Fred has got on his plane, but he catches up to her in the church and it's broad daylight. also, though, I think the better one is Harold shows his mom a picture of a sunflower and then flips it over and it's supposed to be Maud. But when he's showing her the sunflower, you can see the picture and it's of a man with a beard.
Wow. I did not catch that.
That's a man, baby.
It's a man, yeah. All right, funniest moment, John.
I think when the shoot in Paris goes awry, or the when they're having the argument backstage and the fan is blowing and the rain is coming down and it's just a big disaster because they're having the argument and then, you know, they're like, oh, wah, wah, and the thing falls apart. But then the fan keeps going and it rains, like, on the entire audience as well.
Yeah, that's pretty good. What do you think, Ammon?
I went with the way that Harold got out of the army by starting a speech with his uncle about how excited he was and then upping his enthusiasm to a level that not even his uncle could handle.
Yeah. Okay, so I went with Harold again cutting off his hand for his date. So it's odd because these are all, like, at least two of these movies are supposed to be comedies, and there's not a ton of super funny moments. But we have some good what the heck moments. In fact, I have two of them. I've got three of them. But Ammon, what do you got?
So, yeah, I mean, like, pretty much any time that Harold pretended to kill himself, but especially the bloody bathroom, that really...
Yeah.
I don't care if it's a fake thing. Like, I'm with his mom. Like, that's just too much.
John, what do you think? What do you got?
Oh, gosh. I can't quite remember the context, but at one point, Fred Astaire does a dance where he's does a bullfight reenactment.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, no, that's wrong. That doesn't belong.
Okay. So I got a couple. So honorable mentions I have. On their first date, Ray asks Mirabelle if she has a good relationship with her father. And
yeah, that was weird.
That's a weird thing. And then I also have a Harold and Maude sleepover. But then I think the one that caught me the most by surprise, but I kind of loved it, was when Dor is over there and she's having her date with Harold before he kills himself. And she asks Harold if he's ever heard of her drama teacher. And it just seems like my drama teacher is Billy. Have you heard of him? So I don't know. It just seemed really weird. But all right. Best quote, Ammon.
So I went with one of Maude's many inspiring quotes that drove John crazy. Specifically, Dreyfus once wrote from Devil's Island that he would see the most glorious birds. Many years later in Brittany, he realized that they had only been seagulls. For me, they will always be glorious birds.
John, that's a lovely quote. Why do you hate her? Why do you hate Maude so much?
Eh.
Okay. All right, what's your favorite quote, John?
I think also in Harold and Maude, when they were all confronting Harold about, like, hey, why do you want to marry Maude? And I think the psychiatrist says something like, well, many young men your age go through an Oedipal phase where they want to sleep with their mother. What I don't understand, Harold, is why you want to sleep with your grandmother.
Okay, so that's what I picked, but I have another one.
Okay.
So in Funny Face, when the bazaz lady says, we'll mention the shop in the magazine, and Audrey Hepburn says, don't you dare. So anyway. All right, the best scene. And my favorite scene, Ammon, was I think you had it for your funniest moment or one of your awards, but it was when Harold was trying to not join the military by being overly enthusiastic. I love that he had a scalp in his coat.
That was a nice, yeah.
All right, what about you, John? Best scene.
Scene. There it is. Okay. Just the in Funny Face when the whole magazine piles into the bookshop with all their equipment and messes up the bookshop, and then it ends with Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn talking in the bookshop.
Ah, very good. Okay, we are almost there. So, your favorite actor, John?
Well, I got to tell you guys my favorite scene.
Oh, did I? So, right. At least I only skipped one of you guys once. So, Ammon, what's your favorite scene?
Maude's death. I thought that it was strangely moving.
Yeah.
Here's Harold. He's obsessed with death the whole time, and now he's losing his Maude.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not overdone, right? It was kind of the right level of beautifully sad.
Very good. All right, Ammon, who's your favorite actor?
Audrey Hepburn. That's just a priori true.
What do you got, John?
Yeah, I put down Hepburn, but I'm going to put Dovima, the model at the beginning of Funny Face that was supposed to be, Audrey Hepburn. They had her looked up like Audrey Hepburn and everything, but then she said a line and she sounded like some model bimbo, which didn't really match with the way they had her dolled up. So
I love Audrey Hepburn. I'm going to give this award though to Vivian Pickles, who plays Harold's mother. I thought she
did a good job.
I thought she was great. Yeah.
Vivian Pickles is a great name too.
All right. Do any of you have unanswered questions? I don't. We answered mine about whether or not Steve Martin's character is a villain.
Okay, I have two questions.
Okay.
My first question is, Ammon, are you more offended by the portrayal of the philosopher Steve Martin or the philosopher Flostra?
So I'm more like – I think that Flostra hits closer to home.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. Okay, my other question is, I don't understand – what Jeremy's job with fonts is and how his boss had the power to send him to the venue and how the venue had the power to send him on tour. Like the situation, like the weird Rube Goldberg set of events that led Jason Schwartzman to live on the road with this band, I couldn't follow.
Yeah, it seemed very random.
Yeah.
I don't even understand his job at all. Like, it seems like you create one font and that's it for the amp, right?
Yeah.
But like,
yeah.
He was constantly creating new fonts and like he had names for them and I don't know, it was weird. But I don't understand either. And like, once he's on the road with the band, who's paying his expenses? Is the band? I don't understand.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think his expenses are pretty minimal, but.
I mean, just fortunately, like, yeah. But I mean, he still has to be making money somehow with doing whatever he was doing. Like, I don't even know what he was doing. He was just like, his whole job was just to wait for an amp to blow up.
So for every show,
like a real roadie.
For every show that they use his amp, they have to pay royalties. I don't know, because it seems like they weren't using his amp and he swapped it out for one of his amps. I don't understand. I don't have an answer to your question.
Okay, yeah, that was just a weird, weird thing about the movie. I'm like, wait, what? I mean, fortunately, it's good to have those things not being understood rather than, you know,
yeah.
The mechanics of the relationships or whatever, which yeah. I think the movie was much better at.
this movie did not inspire a bunch of slovenly young men to try to join bands on the road as a amp font creators, because that subset of culture did not watch this film. But there was the danger that it might have done that.
Almost, it was the Almost Famous 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, Ammon, you got any unanswered questions?
So, okay. Bear me out here on this one. Did the last blind date actually die? Like, so we're led to believe, like, she believes it's a stage knife, but I don't think we've actually established that it's a stage knife.
Well, she tested.
If it didn't die, why does Harold's mom go, like, basically, like, that's your last date?
That's your last date, because she's actually dead.
It would have gone fine.
Didn't she test the blade on herself and you could see it retracting? I thought she gave it a little test, but
I choose not to believe that. I really want to believe
that she's dead.
Like, this was the last straw, that she's like, oh, okay, no more dates for you. It's the only thing his mom wanted. And also, she's the only date that they would have gotten along with, and that just kind of clinched the whole, well, I better marry Maude now.
All right. Special awards. We got three special awards and then the mix and match. So, grossest couple, John.
Grossest, Ruth and Bud. Ruth Gordon and Bud Cort.
Okay.
Yeah, Harold and Maude.
What about you, Ammon?
So, Mirabel and Steve Martin, but not Steve Martin as Ray Porter, which, like, is just what it is. The fact that Steve Martin is also the narrator who's setting the whole thing up, that's really creepy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I also picked the Steve Martin. So, cutest couple, Ammon.
Okay. So, cutest couple, without a doubt, is Joe and Dick. It's Audrey and Fred Astaire. Sweetest, Harold and Maude.
That's a good differentiation. What do you think, John?
Okay, sweetest or least gross?
Least gross. Let's go with least gross.
I went with Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn, even though it is a mighty big gap, yeah.
So, for least gross, I went with Harold and Maude. It was sweet. It was like, she was doting on her grandson, and then they had sex. I don't know. So, yeah. Okay. All right. Who would you high-five? I would high-five Fred Astaire.
Yeah. I would high-five Fred Astaire. Yeah, it's like, hey, you pulled Audrey. Nice work, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's a dream. So yeah. that's a no-brainer.
All right. Yeah. Okay, mixing and matching. This is how I see the couples as being appropriate. Fred and Maude, because they're actually within like 15 years of each other's age, or they're close, right? And then I've got Claire and Harold, or I call her Claire, Mirabel and Harold, I guess, because the age is there. And then Steve Martin is with Audrey Hepburn. I don't know. I still just see her from that era of film where the silver foxes get the young ladies, and he ages pretty well. So those are my matchups.
Really quick, Ammon, before you go, sorry, that's exactly what I have. Ruth Gordon with Fred Astaire, and then Steve Martin with Audrey Hepburn, which I could totally see, and Claire Danes in Bud Cort, for sure.
Okay, all right. So I went with, not just because, and John, I'm sad that you have to have Harold and Joe.
Oh, Harold and Joe.
Maybe the best Cure song that not a lot of people know, but is maybe their best song.
The best non-album Cure song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, I think that they're both sort of spiritual seekers in similar ways, and I think that they would actually really find one another's company congenial. I'm not sure they would end up like having a sexual relationship or a romantic relationship, but I think they'd be really good friends.
Hmm. Yeah.
Mirabel and Dick. So Claire Danes and Fred Astaire. Because they're both artsy, they both do photography. Mm. I think they'd get along really well, and I think that they would have a deep chemistry. Mm. And Ray and Maude, I love Maude, and I really hope she could do something to Ray. But also, I just really want that fucker to not be dating pretty young women anymore.
Okay. All right.
Sorry for the cursing, but
no, your passion is noted.
Okay, so I do want to mention this before we rank these films. The only movie to pull a profit was Shop Girl. It cost $10 million and it made $11
million. It cost $10
million? Yeah.
That must have all been on the private planes.
Okay, all right. However, it was the lowest rated. It only got 61% on Rotten Tomatoes. Funny Faces first at an 87. Harold and Maude scored an 84, despite Roger Ebert's Sabotage.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, time to rank these. I'm going to let you start, Ammon. What's your number three?
So my number three, and I don't even know if I actually even liked it, ultimately, was Shop Girl.
Okay.
I thought it's funny because, yeah, you were kind of like – I kind of revealed I didn't like Harold and Maude, and you kind of revealed you didn't like Shop Girl in the course of our conversation, which is funny. And I'll just say, okay, my number three is Harold and Maude, and I kind of think – I don't know. Ammon, I think both of us were a little bit, like, unfair to the respective because I'm 90% sure I have this huge resistance to Harold and Maude because I've heard about it all my life, about how quirky and crazy it is. And, you know, hearing about that for 30 years, it really does a number on, you know, my openness to whether or not I find it quirky and crazy, you know. But, yeah, that's mine.
Oh, then what's your number? Okay, my number three then. Oh, I guess I'm the horn. Okay, my number three is Shop Girl. And then this has got to be an effect of recency, right? So I don't know. This would be a different answer a few more years down the road. I went number two, Funny Face. So, John, go ahead.
Wow. Okay. I agree. My number two is Funny Face.
So we all agree that my number two is also Funny Face. I like it. It's got a lot of flaws.
Yeah. That's the thing. It has to be number two. But I think the real interesting thing here is that I feel like I really like Shop Girl and you guys really liked Harold and Maude.
I thought Harold and Maude was so delightful.
Yeah. It was a very unique story, too.
Yeah. And then Shop Girl was also delightful.
John. And I think, you know, we talked about it a little bit. I think Shop Girl was so fascinating because of all the – I don't know. I found it just so much more human than all the other ones. Just because and you know, Jason Schwartzman was probably the most, like, crazy out, you know, just kind of silly, goofy – thing about it, but I totally get, you know, the Steve Martin's villainy. I could totally see that in a regular person such as myself. And I totally understood the connection issues that Claire Danes, you know, goes ahead and has. I think ideally maybe she shouldn't be dealing with anybody at this moment in her life, but I don't know. I think it was just human. That's all I can say. It's just human.
John, you're almost old enough to pull off a Ray Porter. You're pretty close.
I know. I found new reason to study logic, which never.
I can promise you, it's not usually that lucrative. As I talk from my basement studio here,
or sexy. So.
It is that sexy.
It is that sexy. Oh, okay.
John, I will agree with you. I think it was, in terms of, like, as a constructed movie, I think it was the best constructed of them as a movie. Mm-hmm. Very solid story. I just found it too moralistic, ultimately.
Okay, yeah. I definitely see that. Especially, like, I kind of don't think it needs, like, the narration is off, you know?
Yeah.
Like, That was just a little too – it's like, no, don't give me the narration. Just let me just see these people live.
Yeah, I think it's – yeah.
All right. Well done, folks. Ammon, thank you so much for joining us for two podcasts.
Yeah, it's been fun.
I thought this was a good category for you to discuss because of all the philosophies and all the sexiness.
All the philosophies, all the sexiness.
Yeah, which – you're experts at both. So, okay. So we got some business to take care of really quickly. So the next podcast will be, I think, 3 weeks from now. John, is that right? Giving
what
ourselves.
What day did you say? You have it on a calendar. Sometime in December after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
We're going to do Christmas movies. Yeah.
Let's see. I'll just tell you right now. It is going to be – this is pretty exciting for you guys.
The 9th. So, yeah, I think December 2nd would be 2 weeks from now. We're doing it on the 9th.
Okay.
Because we need a break, and because John and I at some point have to squeeze in some serious Star Trek podcasting. I don't know when that's going to happen. Anyway, so the point is you guys voted, and we are definitely watching A Muppet's Christmas Carol.
Yes.
And John, just about 30 minutes ago, came to the aid of my breaking heart, and we are also watching Heidi.
Okay.
Have you ever seen that before, John?
No, I don't know. I don't even know why I voted for it.
Is Heidi a Christmas movie, or is it just set with a guy who looks like Santa Claus?
Well, there is that, but it definitely, like, the last third of the film takes place on Christmas Eve and Christmas.
Okay, I forgot.
Yeah. I get, because my other choices were Ernest Saves Christmas or Krampus.
Which now, because those two are tied, here it comes. So I'm just a random number generator here. Krampus is 1, Ernest is 2.
Okay.
I'm just going to hit generate until you tell me to stop.
Which is the bigger villain between those two, Ernest or Krampus?
I will say... I think I'd rather watch Krampus just because it's one I haven't seen. But I do recall watching Ernest Saves Christmas, and 9-year-old me was not super impressed by the comedy in Ernest Saves Christmas.
Oh, 44-year-old will not – you will also not be super impressed. But
yeah, yeah. All right. Go ahead and stop the randomness.
Okay. Let's see where we're at. Friends, we are watching Ernest Saves Christmas.
Why did you make me say something about Ernest Saves Christmas? I jinxed it. All right.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not going to be here with you guys to talk about it, I'm very excited you're watching The Muppets. I don't love Charles Dickens, but I love The Muppet Christmas Carol. Also, yet another argument to watch Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, since you've got Mr. Michael Caine.
Michael Caine, yeah.
Michael Caine. Now, did I say this to you guys last time? I've heard over and over and over and over again that Muppet's Christmas Carol is the best Christmas Carol, but I've never seen Muppet's Christmas Carol.
No, it is 100% the best Christmas Carol. I completely agree.
I think it is. My runner-up is a 1951 version with Alastair Sim, but it's most versions of A Christmas Carol are pretty crappy. So the Muppets Christmas Carol is probably the best one, which also, like, we're no longer going to ever vote for another Christmas Carol movie because we're doing this one. This is kind of the one that's going to happen.
I disagree. I think next year we should watch 3 different Christmas Carol movies.
As long as one of them is with Patrick Stewart and the other one is with George C. Scott.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, the George C. Scott for sure. Yeah. And, who's the other one? There's the Scrooge. There's the musical Scrooge, which, and we already watched Scrooged one year.
Yeah, that's
the biggest fan of it. As I am of Bill Murray, I've never seen Scrooge.
It's all right.
I'm curious. I really hated it.
It has. Just me, it's got Marianne Ravenwood in it. She's delightful. The rest of the movie's pretty.
Yeah.
Anyway. The other news is after December 9th, we're going to take a little bit of a break. But that's a special podcast because John and I were doing our year review. The year review. So Christmas and we'll wrap up the year. But then in January.
That's for Christmas. Oh, I should mention, everybody listening, if you listen this far, I should have mentioned it earlier. Call into our number and tell us, you know, your favorite or least favorite or movie you saw for the first time or the biggest surprise or biggest whatever. Just the biggest memory you had of watching a movie from the podcast.
Yeah.
And I should say, oh gosh, I can't. Where is it? It's I'm just going to quickly give the number right now, and I'm going to give it at the end again. The number is 801-896-4542, 801-896-4542. So now is the time to get those voicemails in.
Yeah.
Now more than ever.
I think I'll probably also throw up a poll with every movie we did this last year. And people can vote as much as they want, but we want to put your voices on the podcast so you can become as famous as Ammon now is.
Yeah.
So Ammon, when you
on the streets now,
yeah,
hard.
when you get a bump in pay, you're welcome. So
yeah.
All right, and then in January we are being guest hosted with the fabulous Katie Rockwood.
Lovely Katie Rockwood.
Yeah.
Yes. She's going to join us with 3 movies, and she told me she narrowed it down to, like, I think 11.
Oh, well, good. She's got a month to narrow it down to three. Unless she wants to do a six-movie podcast. But anyway. So the other thing is we had you guys voting on some categories, but we're going to let that poll go for one more podcasting cycle. Just to get things back in sync with the flow of how it's supposed to go.
Okay, and everybody listening, remember next year the rules are, right?
Mm-hmm.
The rules are if you've been on the podcast before, you get to pick three new movies, but this time they're not your three favorite movies. They're three movies that you have not seen. So three movies that may be on your list. This will be your excuse to like knock off three movies that you've always meant to see. And so it'll be fun because you'll watch it with the two of us as well.
So I it sounds like you and I aren't going to get the chance to do that, which is fine. But I'm not trying to influence anyone, but I was thinking like if this were my choice and I was picking three movies I'd never seen before, and I didn't have a theme, but it just turned out this way. I think I really want to see Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, 13 Years a Slave, and Malcolm X. Those are three movies that I've never seen and would love to. But anyway.
Was there a sequel to 12 Years a Slave called 13 Years a Slave?
Yes, but I guess we could watch the original movie first. That's fine, whatever. Okay.
That's a good group. If I were to pick, I think I'd pick the 7-hour War and Peace made by the Soviet Union.
I've always wanted to see that. I love a good War and Peace. I don't know what I'd pick. I'm going to think about that in case I ever do decide to come back and haunt you guys again.
Like yeah, no. You don't have a choice, Ammon. Plan on it next year. Be thinking of yourself. Movies you've never seen. Don't watch anything between now and then.
Yep. All right. So anyway, we'll have a couple polls up. But one of them, again, remember that the voting is still going on for Into the Wild films, Cassandra Conundrum films, and artsy Chinese films. I think Into the Wild films maybe has a special place in Katie's heart because she's the kind of person that likes to go into the wild.
Yeah.
Is she a big fan of Grizzly Man?
Oh, I need to ask her if she's a fan of Grizzly. That's the one – that's the documentary, right, about the guy who lived with the bears, right?
Until it ate him.
Like they found his – like a bucket of his corpse.
That was the grossest relationship was him and the bears.
I'll find that out.
All right. Anyway, that's all I got. But there's some good news for all you folks. If you're listening to this for the first time, we've done 75 of these now. And that doesn't include the apocryphal ones from our Star Trek podcast. By the way, check out JR Watches Star Trek for the first time as we discuss every single episode and movie ever from Star Trek. We are currently doing Prodigy and Discovery, or at least we're supposed to. But also go to our blog at yoursmindtheirspodcast.blogspot.com where you can see all the notes for every episode. You can download every episode, and it's lots of fun. But the real big deal is you got to get on Meta, otherwise known as Facebook, which is where we keep all the democracy stuff. That's where you help us pick the category we're going to watch, and then you determine at least one of the three movies we're going to watch. So it's a lot of fun, in theory. And also, please go to wherever you listen to this podcast and give us 5 stars, and then say whatever you want. It doesn't matter at that point.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ammon, thanks for staying up late. Roy, thanks for staying up late. John, it's time for dinner where you're at,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's time for dinner. It's a nice, reasonable time here in the Mountain Time Zone. So, yeah, it's too bad you guys can't join me in the time zone. But no problem. Happy Thanksgiving. And we'll be talking Christmas next time.
Yay. All right, guys. Have a good one.
And by the way, say whatever you want, but turns out I missed – I usually just – it's actually more fun than anything, but I like beeping swear words in it, and I missed one of your F-bombs last week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which is
– I didn't even –
If any of the censors at iTunes or Apple Music or whoever, like, listen, then, you know, they could...
You're going to, like, a $30 fine.
I don't think I would be surprised if it was a $30 fine, but...
If it is, I will pay it for you, John.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I'm just... I'm annoyed with myself because I'm supposed to like listen to this podcast after we do it, and apparently I just
wasn't listening. Did I have a bunch? I don't remember having a lot of F-bombs, but maybe
I did. You had two, and I got one, but not the other. And actually, you know what? You had one. You only had one.
That's enough for an R rating.
Yeah, it is enough for the R. No, you had two because one of them was in the outtake. If you told anybody to like listen to it, you know, there's an outtake at the end where you didn't think you were being recorded, but I thought it was funny, and so I put it in.
I have a theory, and it has to do with the idea that men don't stop thinking fart jokes are funny until they hit like 55. So maybe it's a maturity thing.
They can't control the amount of farting they do.
Yeah, there's no controlling. So anyway, all right, you guys ready or what? Let's get this going. Yep. Okay. All right. Hey, everybody, welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the fourth greatest